know where the water came from?
Yeah, Opal Springs.
No, you know. I mean, who handed them out?
Does anybody know why my seal's broken?
Cyanide is a clear.
Down the hat.
Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is Wednesday, April 27th, 2005. I'm Representative Greg Smith, and with me is Robin Lamont, our professional staff, and Kat Bell, our committee assistant. Today we're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 5508, Economic and Community Development Department. And for those who are visiting with us for the first time on this budget, this session, in round one, we started out at a 30,000-foot level, and we had an opportunity for a little while to go through the budget and to get an overview. In round two, this is an opportunity to continue the overview, but to also really delve down into the numbers, to ask questions, to find out how programs work, and to take the good products that are out there and sharpen them up, if you will. What we're going to do is, some of you may have seen a current or a previous rendition of the...
It was not distributed.
It was not distributed, okay. What we're going to do is have, just so everyone knows, is first we'll have opening comments from Director Brantley. Then we're going to ask Mr. Fox to come up and do a presentation on industry sector outreach. Then we're going to go to Sarah Garrison, who's going to do community development block grant. Then we're going to go to Victoria Pruitt, who will be doing small business programs, and then Victoria will follow up with the business finance programs. Then we're going to go to invited testimony, and we're going to ask each of you to come up, and we'll go in order of the divisions that we went through previously. Then after that, we're going to do public testimony. My understanding is I've had a chance to talk with several people who are going to be coming for public testimony. They may be running a little bit late, and so hopefully that'll work out. Now, for the committee, this is the point where I encourage questions to be asked. In round one, we tried to, you know, again, stay at the higher level. This is the place to ask those questions. I will stay the entire length of time it takes to get through the entire agenda. If any of you need to leave, please do so. And if we can get you copies of the remaining committee, just let us know and we'll make sure we do that. So with that, we're going to actually ask you gentlemen to come up in a little bit.
Okay.
If that's okay. Are they with the department?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they were requested to do opening comments.
Okay. Let me. If you would like to do that, that's fine. How are you doing, Mr. Lee? Good seeing you. Why don't we do that? And then what I do want to share with everyone is we are going to hold to the sections and allow invited testimony up after that. Okay? So you two gentlemen will be giving us the opening comments, I guess. Marty.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'm sorry I did not see that copy, and so I had previously invited the two gentlemen that I have in front of me. As you might be aware, yesterday what we tried to do is tell our story a little bit about how we interface with all the rest of the state and how the department interfaces with that and the progress that we have made throughout the last couple of years, and particularly with the emphasis on jobs and the direction that you all had given us on the jobs and where we were today. That conversation will continue a little bit because I think that that's what one of the questions that you ask consistently in the first phase, if you will, is how is it that you all operate, how do you interface with the local communities, and how do we know that everybody is being paid attention to, if you will. And so there will be some comments about how each one of our programs works and how people are able to participate in that. Also, there are some talking points for everybody of today's discussions, and so in front of you, hopefully you have those talking points. And also, just to remind you also that in your binder, there is a Phase 2 tab, if you will, and much of the information that was asked for has been put in the tab for you also to look at. Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to introduce two people today that have some opening comments. On my far left is Roger Lee. He's Executive Director of Economic Development for Central Oregon. And as you know, that covers three counties, Deschutes, Crooks, and Jefferson counties. Roger is a person that we all know is to be really commended for his leadership in the business as well as the community side of things, and I'm delighted that he will talk a little bit about Central Oregon and our interfacing with the programs there. And after that, I have Steve Vinson on my immediate left, and Steve Vinson is from Southern Oregon with the Avista Utilities, and he's a member of the Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development and part of the Regional Investment Board also. Steve has some observations because his company operates in three different Northwest states and is familiar with economic development on all three of those states. So, Roger, if you could start, that would be great.
Mr. Roger, I haven't seen you in...
been a number of years. Yeah, it has been.
A long time.
Mr. Chair and Marty, I'd like to just defer on to Steve first of all. He's going to give you a 20,000 foot view, and I'll give you the 35,000 or 3,500 foot level from Ben. So.
Terrific.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Vincent with Avista Utilities. I'm going to try and give you about a 200,000 foot view. If you look at the western United States, Avista Utilities has customers customers in three Northwest states. We also serve in California as well as have employees and facilities in Montana. And what my counterparts in Avista Utilities who do economic development in Washington and Idaho are telling me, these are the people who actually work in recruitment, go out and meet with companies around the country, meet with corporate site selectors. When it comes to a head-to-head competition in recruiting a company between our three states, telling me that Oregon wins most of the time. Now, we didn't get Boeing, but I don't think that we're going to win Boeing anyhow. But the point is that that's their biggest complaint to me, is losing out to Oregon. And I think there are a variety of reasons. First off, we have incentives and programs within the state that do allow us a slight competitive advantage over Washington and Idaho, enough of an advantage that the example of Royal Caribbean deciding to go to Eugene, they basically were looking at Spokane or Eugene as the two, their two final sites to consider. They chose Oregon because of the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund. But we can't always win on the numbers, and I'll use another example. I'm working with a company from Madrid that's looking at locating their first manufacturing facility in the United States. They're looking at New Jersey, somewhere near Virginia, San Antonio, and Oregon. And we're not going to win on the numbers. In San Antonio, they've offered this company a free building. It'll probably save them close to $6 million in the transaction. But they still continue to return to Grants Pass. And I believe that we will be successful, not because we have a deeper checkbook, but because we have an agency and we have local people who are able to massage the relationship and work through the transaction to a point that this company and these folks from Spain feel more comfortable with siting their plant in Oregon than in Texas, even though Texas can certainly write a bigger check. A couple of points back to our competitive advantage. Our lobbyists in Washington and Idaho before this legislative session last fall spent their time developing legislative strategies, and all of their strategies were based on what Oregon already has. And to further complement that, my former boss, who is on this commission, is now the chair of the Washington Commission. And he often tells me, boy, Steve, you don't know how easy you've got it. Because in Washington, they don't have an agency that operates like Oregon's does. And they don't have a governor's office or a legislative process that supports the agency like you all have for several decades. And so that gives us a further competitive advantage in recruiting companies to Oregon that are also looking at the other two Northwest states. Back to that high-level view, as in the last couple of years, as I have traveled to New York and Chicago and L.A. to meet with corporate site consultants on bringing their companies to Oregon, usually those trips include staff from the agency, and their capability is extraordinary. In those circumstances, their ability to sell the state and bring those recruitments to Oregon. And I know that my counterparts, again, are jealous of that because they don't have that capability and they don't have those people and that staff. And I think that it's that capability that is allowing us to work our way out of this recession. So I guess I would implore you that whatever structural changes that you make to this agency, that we have more at risk than we have to gain. I realize that there are service issues and performance issues, but when I look at it, as I spend my time in Washington, Idaho, things are working pretty well in the state of Oregon because of the wins that we keep coming up with. So any questions, be happy to answer them. Thank you for the time.
You mentioned structural changes. Is there specific legislation you're referring to?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Any questions? Welcome.
Well, thanks again for a chance to provide some testimony later and just some opening comments now. I've been doing economic development in Oregon now for about 11 years, both in eastern and central Oregon, and had a chance to see
the... Please identify.
I'm sorry. Roger Lee with Economic Development for Central Oregon. We've been doing this job in central Oregon for about the past 6 years, and I've had a chance to see the state working on a more urban level and certainly on a rural level with different projects. And I can say that unequivocally, I've never had a project go south because of the department's lack of participation. They've always been there. They've helped close the deals. We've had a lot of good success in Oregon and the communities I've worked in, largely due to the state's tools, the state staff, and the ability to get projects done. And it's maybe sound like an easier task than it really is. It's about relationships. It's about continuity. The business community likes continuity, and I think that it's been a real challenge. That's probably been the greatest challenge in Oregon. I tell this story frequently. I think Oregon really has a bit of schizophrenia when it comes to economic development. One day it's in vogue when the economy is doing poorly, when it starts to rebound, suddenly economic development and jobs are kind of a four-letter word. And that's something I think, you know, in this current economy, which is rebounding, is something that we need to keep some continuity, both at the state level and certainly throughout the community level. And I can tell you that the projects and companies we are working with, there are very few local tools, quite frankly. Most of the tools we have in Oregon come at the state level. And I'm a personal believer that they work pretty well at the state level, especially when it comes to, for example, finance programs. Again, we've not had companies turned down or delayed on decisions for finance programs in our area. That, and I'll provide some testimony hopefully later as to some of the numbers. But it's been a critical department for our success, both in eastern Oregon and central Oregon now. Without the department, I think we can look at a lot of our projects going to some of those other states that we're competing with on a regular basis.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Let me ask you this, Roger. You've been doing economic development for a long time, and you talked about the schizophrenic nature of economic development. Do you think the approaches in the department have been schizophrenic? If you remember in the mid-90s, we were doing regional strategies, and then we transferred to some other strategy, and now we're moving to a new one. About every 5-6 years, we go to a new strategy.
It's a good question. I don't know if you're going to like my answer. It's my answer, and you can take it for what it's worth. But I think most of the schizophrenia has, quite frankly, come out of the legislature. Right. It's been in vogue. It's not been in vogue. I think the department's tried to have some constancy in their programs. The shift of last session from economic development to community and economic development was a reaction to a strong economy. And I think if they had to change the name again, it would be the Economic Development Department again, and less on the community side. So in the department's defense, I think most of the people working at the staff level would prefer some continuity and not perhaps be pulled one direction or another from the executive or the legislative branch of the government. So
taking your comments, could we say then that we shouldn't do any new initiatives? We should just maintain the status?
Absolutely not. I think that if Oregon could do anything, look at their programs, maybe look at modernizing the programs, perhaps adding some additional. We've actually looked at doing that in our own organization, looking at best practices around the country on how things work. But obviously not breaking things that are working.
Thank you. Thank you. Excellent testimony. We appreciate that.
Mr. Chair?
Oh,
I'd just
Senator
like
Wessel.
Compliment Roger and Steve as well for their long-term commitment to economic development and their service to the state of Oregon. I mean, you guys, thank you.
Thank you.
field of attention.
Welcome. Thank you. Both of you can just introduce your names for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Fox. I'm the manager of the Business Development Division for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. And I have the pleasure this afternoon of sharing with you some insights into one of the tools that Steve and Roger spoke to earlier about that are part of the department's initiative to support both the individual businesses that make Oregon's economy strong, but also the industry groups that make Oregon's economy unique in a global marketplace. Today I want to speak to you about the Industry Sector Outreach Fund. This is a fund that is allocated by our commission based on the legislative approved budget for each biennium. The Industry Sector Outreach Fund is really directed to promote the overall capacity for Oregon's industrial sectors, which are really groups of businesses ranging from food processing, wood processors, metal fabrications, bioscience, software, high technology, the full range of industrial or value-based businesses. The fund is targeted to assist the Strategic Reserve, on the other hand, one of the other funds that you have and we'll hear more about, I believe, is targeted to assist individual businesses. Again, I think Steve and Roger both mentioned the importance of that fund in making it possible for Oregon to match the competitive gaps that exist in challenging companies to choose an Oregon location. The Industry Sector Outreach Fund is proposed to be funded in the 2005-07 biennium at the same amount, $1.6 million, as was included in the 2003-2005 legislatively approved budget. Now, I think it's important to set a little context relative to Oregon's economy. Some recent data indicates that Oregon is actually second among the states in the United States in the percent of the state's gross state product that is the result of manufacturing industries in the state. Only the state of Indiana leads in that category, and surprisingly, recently mentioned Boeing, the state of Washington is 30th in that list, so they are substantially less dedicated to manufacturing industry than the state of Oregon is. The closest state to us in the Pacific Northwest is Idaho, which is 13th at that list. So Indiana leads, Oregon is second, Washington is 30th, and the other states are scattered. And that's data that's actually made available through the Oregon Business Council's recent index of Oregon performance indicators, which I use regularly in my contacts with other companies both inside the state and outside the state. Additionally, I should mention that the Oregon Business Council in their Oregon Business Plan I think set a great direction for the state and the department in terms of focusing on these clusters of industrial businesses that make the Oregon economy strong and strengthen that. And it's that partnership that the department utilizes its industry sector outreach between industry groups to grow that capacity within the state. Commitments from the Industry Sector Outreach Fund are made after evaluations and input from industry groups, from associations, recommendations from the governor's office, and collaborations with local economic development organizations. We use our established relationships with industrial groups to determine where our investments from the industry sector outreach can have the greatest benefit to Oregon businesses and industry sectors. Often we cannot provide the entire amount that is requested, but we work to assure that our commitment is sufficient to deliver to the industry the need and the capacity that the opportunity represents. The Industry Sector Outreach Fund generally requires a matching from the industry group, trade association, or economic development organizations, thereby increasing the leverage and the extension to which the funds provided by the legislature makes it possible for us to assist those businesses. I think it's real important to note that without the industry sector funds, our ability to help an industry group, economic development association, or trade associations grow and expand those sectors of the Oregon economy that make our state unique in comparison to others wouldn't be there. Today, I have invited four people who will represent two of the major funding commitments made from the Industry Sector Outreach Fund in the 2003-2005 biennium. And I want to just touch briefly on a couple of those topics, and I'll leave most of my time to allow them to testify later when you're able to call them forward. And our commitments from the Industry Sector Fund in the current biennium are really have been concentrated in three major areas of focus. The first is in assisting businesses in improving their manufacturing efficiency through the implementation of high-performance manufacturing processes. Additionally, we have provided funds to market Oregon. That is to promote both Oregon's unique products, whether they are agricultural, seafood, or other products, and also, as Roger and Steve alluded to market Oregon as a place for business investment. Another area is our investments in to promote market trade assistance to companies and small companies in Oregon who are looking to extend their market reach into international markets that they currently do not reach. A couple of a little more detail on some of the examples that I've mentioned too. Manufacturing performance assistance is delivered to Oregon's small and medium manufacturing businesses to create the kind of high performance production enhancements through the application of lean manufacturing that permits them to exceed performance and to compete in a global marketplace. We have an agreement, a contract agreement, with the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, and later today I think you'll hear from Patrick Murphy, Executive Director for OMEP, and Tom White Hay from the Burley Co-op, who will talk about the applications of lean manufacturing to Oregon business. With the $500,000 that the department committed from its Industry Sector Outreach Fund, OMEP was able to leverage an equal or greater amount of money from the National Institute of Science and Technology, NIST, to support the statewide delivery of specialized assessments and training to small and medium manufacturing businesses across Oregon. So the performance agreement with our department and OMEP provides for lean manufacturing assistance to be delivered to a total of 93 manufacturing businesses across the state to increase their productivity, lower costs, and improve overall competitiveness, leading to a sustainable business success. Through December of 2004, the last full reporting period, 69 manufacturing businesses had received OMEP assistance under the performance agreement, resulting in the retention and creation of 1,251 jobs. Using the average wage for OMEP-assisted businesses, which is right at $45,000 per employee, those 1,251 employees equal approximately $56 million in annual payroll that have benefited Oregon Some examples that I've had some contact with that I think are indicative of the kind of assistance companies receive through OMEP and its lean manufacturing assistance. It's a small company located in the Portland area called Bushwhacker. They actually manufacture aftermarket components for vehicles. They are essentially in the they service the four-wheel drive market. They sell extruded plastic components that are added on to vehicles after purchase. Utilizing the assistance from lean manufacturing, they've been able to improve their production efficiencies and actually compete directly for business from the major manufacturers, which without that assistance they say they would never have been able to achieve. Another story that for me has always been indicative of the value that lean manufacturing represents is a company located just west of here in Independence. A Marquis Spa is a locally employee-owned business that manufactures an extensive line of spas, the kind that you relax in. I hope you get a chance to relax in a Marquis Spa at some point in time during the next few months. Marquis business has been very successful, and they were contemplating a major capital investment to expand their productivity capacity. After the evaluation and assistance from the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, they were able to increase their productivity, improve their product throughput, and increase the number of product introductions that they could make without having to invest that capital that otherwise would have required a cost of business. So they've achieved much of everything they intended to as a result of this assistance without having to capitalize those costs. Without the industry sector outreach resource, those 69 companies that OMEP has served through December of 2004 would not have received those benefits and assistance, and the production improvements and made them more competitive in the global economy. The second major area of investment that I think is important to bring to your attention is Market Oregon. That effort is to attract new traded sector businesses through through the commitments to the Oregon Economic Development Association and to the commitment of funds for the Brand Oregon campaign that promotes increased market opportunities for Oregon agriculture, seafood products, as well as increased tourism across the state. The Brand Oregon campaign has increased sales, improved profits, and has led to direct new investments in Oregon. I've invited Debbie Kennedy, who's the director for the Brand Oregon campaign, and Tim McCabe, who today really carries two hats. He's with PacifiCorp, but he's also the past president of Oregon Economic Development Association and has been an active member in that organization's marketing campaign. And the last example that I would share with you is really to just refer you back to testimony you received yesterday from Dave Zapponi from the Northwest Food Processors Association. Dave made comment to an investment that we've made. It's actually a set-aside of money committed to the Northwest Food Processors to help them realize a regional industry cluster strategy that industry group has determined is essential to their long-term success. Through our department, through the governor's assistance, we made a commitment to that organization early in their process. They have subsequently used that money in their negotiations with the state of Washington, the state of Idaho, and industry and the federal government, and have just recently successfully reached their goal of raising approximately $280,000, including a commitment from our department for $35,000 from the Industry Sector Outreach Fund for the purpose of completing an efficiency and analysis of the industry's capacity across the Northwest states. Food processing, as Dave mentioned to you yesterday, is not singularly constrained to the businesses to Oregon. They actually move product back and forth across state lines, and their ability to be competitive is really dictated by this assessment. So with that, I think I will stop, answer questions, and reserve some time for my guests to speak to you.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to the lean manufacturing, could you describe the transaction that occurs between the provider, OMEP, and the companies? Specifically, what kind of reimbursement for services is there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I will give you an answer, but I think Patrick Murphy will spend a little more time on it, but let me give you a quick answer. The OMEP is funded, as I mentioned, from monies provided by the federal government, matched with monies from our department through our Industry Sector Outreach Fund. But OMEP also charges a fee to the businesses who participate. And I think Patrick will tell you that fee, while it is less than, say, fair market value for the services received, what it does is it dedicates a commitment from that company to both commit to the lean manufacturing approach to production, but it also means that they've put their money into that effort. So the fee is based on the evaluation made by OMEP in terms of the complexity of the assessment necessary and the work plan that they will provide to that business. So there are really three funding sources that make the lean manufacturing assistance from OMEP possible for Oregon's small and medium-sized manufacturers.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fox, thank you for this information. It's really valuable. I'm trying to get a sense. I mean, I know what OMEP does, and they have their own budget and their own funding sources. I'm trying to get a sense of how much it costs for OECDD to administer the industry sector outreach, and I don't know where to find that in the materials that I have.
Representative Richardson, for the record, Cora Parker from the Budget Management Division. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, are you talking about the cost to administer the fund per se, so sort of the operational cost behind it, or are you talking about transactional costs?
The cost to administer.
Okay. Again, Representative Richardson, those costs actually are borne by the Operations Division, and we'll hear, when we get to that division, we'll hear about how those are, I won't say allocated because that's not appropriate. That is largely borne by direct lottery funds, but we'll speak to how basically those funds are administered across the division. Is that responsive?
Just follow up. When you say those funds, I'm talking about expenditures of OECD to administer this one branch of the work that you do.
Right. So to clarify, you're talking about accounting transactions, accounting staff, management staff, et cetera, related to a particular fund. And again, for the most part, and I'm going to broaden that to all funds, but for the most part, those sort of operational costs are borne by the operations division out of lottery funds specifically. So because it's lottery funds in the industry sector fund, or in the fund that Ron's been speaking about, and it's lottery funds bearing the major operational costs, it doesn't make sense to have sort of a chargeback model that maybe you're used to seeing, for example, in human services or something, where there are a multitude of fund sources. So operations, the division, bears the brunt of those costs just directly. In some cases where other funds are involved, there are some direct service charges related specifically to direct projects and direct amounts of time that are spent on certain transactions. But there's not an allocation per se back to any of the funds. I don't get the sense that I'm answering your question appropriately, but I think...
I don't know how much it costs for this. And let me
just try this. I think when we get to the operations division and we talk about the type of work that's done there, I think we'll answer your questions and some of it will become more clear to you.
Okay, thank you.
Let me ask a few questions. Mr. Fox, it's truly good seeing you here. I'm a big fan of your work. Industry sector outreach, where in the department's management chart would it fall? Does it fall under the market development section? Who administers the program?
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, I think I mentioned in my opening comments, it's the Industry Sector Outreach Fund is one of the funds that's allocated from the Community Development Fund by our commission based on a legislative approved budget. The funds are administered by my division. But as
the market development.
Well, I think it's referred. I think in your material it's referred to as the domestic business development effort.
Chart that looks like this. No, I don't expect you to be able to read it.
Yeah.
It has market development, innovative economy, business development support,
business development.
Okay.
I think it would be under the business development as you've listed.
Business development support. Okay. So then, does the you've got $1.6 million, and for the folks who are in here, please know we're a budget committee, not a policy committee. We have two great policy committees that will carry out their work in other places. Our job is just to make sure we have an understanding of where money flows. So I just want to let people know why we're doing this. $1.6 million. Who makes the allocation determination on where that $1.6 million goes?
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, those decisions are made by the management team within the department, including the director and the division managers, including myself. And we make those decisions. Let me step back. Let me go back just a second and say, as I mentioned in my testimony, we work closely with the industry associations, Metals Consortium Group, a group of metals fabrication companies. We've mentioned previously the Northwest Food Processors. We are in constant dialogue with those organizations. So we are working with them to determine how best the state can support their industry growth and competitiveness. So they come to us and say, as in the case of the Northwest Food Processors, we believe the thing that will make our industry most competitive and going forward in the marketplace is an analysis and an assessment of the industry's capacity across the multi-states.
How do you make sure that every industry knows that there's $1.6 million available that they can come forward and try and access?
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, we've really, our work in identifying these significant industry groups that make that form Oregon's economy, and we have individual staff that we've assigned as the direct liaison with those industry groups. So in the case of the Northwest Food Process Association, Tom Fox, who is our business development officer here in the Willamette Valley, is actually tasked with that direct connection with the association. Now, we work also closely with individual food processing businesses, whether they're located in Medford or Albany or in your communities in central and eastern central Oregon.
Can you help the committee by just sharing a breakdown of the 1.6 million? Not exact dollars, but just kind of ballpark on it.
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, I believe in the material we have provided to you, we've broken it down into a total, I think, of six categories of investment, which is sort of the planning method that we took this biennium to that. And it's contained in your material. I'm going to need to look at the documents. You have to reference it to you. Chairman Smith, members of the committee, in the materials that we provided you under Phase 2 testimony, under the tab marked Industry Sector Outreach, I think on page 2 of that document, on the left-hand side of the page, it is a program budget for 0305, and we have broken out in these broad categories of investment, and I mentioned Marketing Oregon, the industry sector, the manufacturing assistance, and so on.
Is it possible to get a breakdown of how that one... What's the size of the agreements? Are they larger agreements? Are they micro agreements?
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, the answer initially is yes, yes.
Yeah.
But let me say this. The reason that I included comments about the manufacturing efficiency agreement and the Market Oregon, those are the two largest aggregate agreements in terms of funding commitments for this biennium, the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership. We've provided them, under a performance contract, $500,000 for this biennium. They, again, use that money to match federal funds, and that becomes part of their operating budget to provide those services. Market Oregon, which has included commitments to the Oregon Economic Development Association for their business marketing campaign, and to the joint Brand Oregon effort that includes OEDA and the Brand Oregon, I think that's about $500,000 or $600,000. And then there are other marketing efforts that are included in that number that's listed in the material we've provided you in that hand, that response.
I think that Market Oregon's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Thank you. Let me just ask one or two more questions, if I may. Clarify for me again, when each of us go home to our individual districts, how do we let folks know that they have an ability to pursue an industry sector outreach grant agreement?
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, I think the answer that I would most likely provide would be that it is through the aggregation of the businesses that are portions of these industry groups. We work closely with industry associations that
are... Industries need to come forward to you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really an industry group process. Now, I should say that at times you'll have an individual business that will present a concept. Generally, that is taken to the industry group. We like to see broad support by the businesses that make up those categories. Again, it's part of the evaluation we use to determine whether our investments are appropriate in terms of timing and amount, but also that this initiative meets the expectations and the identified needs that the industry group has developed.
Do they need to bring a plan forward to you, or do they just come with a concept?
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, actually, we kind of use a two-step process. We say, give us your concept. We'll determine if it fits our funding capabilities and does it meet the criteria that has been provided for us. And then we ask them for a more formalized, what we call project budget, that says, in the case of the Northwest Food Processors, as an example, they came forward with a budget that was initially, I think, approximately $250,000. And we said, we're anxious to participate because this is important to Oregon's economy, but we want to see your success at raising funds from the other states and the industry, and we actually encourage them to pursue the federal government, which they
are able. You're able to keep these associations from being led on by doing kind of a two-phase approach. Talk to us first.
Yes.
If it makes sense, then let's proceed.
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, that is a good description of our process.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Fick. Well, I had one last question. I'm sorry, and I should have asked this yesterday. And Chair Johnson in our other committee taught me to do this. I have to pass this to somebody.
Well, this is Betsy's fault.
This is Betsy's fault. In round one, we went through a set of prioritizations. And obviously, we have limited amounts of dollars. And this committee went through and took what you folks had provided us and prioritized it. In the case of industry sector outreach, it ranked kind of low, very low. Is there anything this committee needs to know that we misjudged, we misguessed in terms of overall prioritizing each of these, in terms of this?
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, I hope that at least once you have heard the comments that Lean Manufacturing, Patrick Murphy, and Tom Wright-Hay have to share with you, and the information that Debbie Kennedy and Tim McCabe have to say as two examples, in addition to what you heard yesterday from Dave Zapponi from the Northwest Food Processors, we will have collectively convinced you that these are funds that are absolutely essential to driving the state's economy, and that we do have an appropriate process for interface with industries and direct our support appropriately to their initiatives.
I appreciate that. I just want to let everyone out there know that in round one we did do a prioritization, and so much of the commentary that people have had an opportunity to comment on, if you will, is based upon this document. So thank you very much. Let's see here. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you.
Community Development Block Grant.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Garrison. I'm the Capital Projects Division Manager at the department. I do appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about the Community Development Block Grant Program. It is a federally funded grant program. And since the 1980s, the state of Oregon has been administering these funds on the behalf of cities and counties, the non-entitlement cities and counties in Oregon. Those non-entitlement cities and counties are those by basis of their population are not large enough to get funds directly from the U.S. Housing and Urban Development, or as we call it, HUD. Prior to the 1980s, before the state of Oregon's program began, each city and county had to compete on a national basis for these funds. Many of our communities did not apply because they either lacked capacity to initiate or manage a project, or they just didn't have the resources to apply at all. As a result, Oregon received little, if any, of these federal community development block grant funds. Over the last 5 years, for the state of Oregon, we've received an average of about $16 million per year, or $32 million per biennium. The primary purpose of the funds is really to provide economic opportunities, suitable living environments like safe drinking water and clean wastewater, and to provide decent housing, and all of these are principally for people of low and moderate income. So these funds do help our residents that basically need it the most.
Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson.
Ms. Garrison, you've just touched on a question that I think a number of us have had, particularly where we are sitting on the panel that's listening to housing and community development's budget. And that is why it is that we have two separate agencies doing low-income housing and affordable housing, and whether or not there's any part of the CDBG that could be split apart so that we've got one-stop shopping for these kinds of projects, either in your shop, and housing and community development doesn't do that, or you give up that piece that might be more appropriately administered in Mr. Repine's shop.
Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, I think we've already done that to some degree. The Housing and Urban Development wants one applicant, and there's many different things that any state can do with Community Development Block Grant. The majority of what we have decided to do, and we do it through what's called an annual method of distribution, and we have immense stakeholder involvement in deciding how we use the funds each year that we get from the Housing and Urban Development. There are two of the categories that we use, which are housing rehabilitation and housing resource centers, are managed by the Oregon Community and OHCS, Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, because we do use their expertise in the housing arena. We subgrant, which is the method that HUD tells us to do, we subgrant a portion of those funds to Oregon Housing Community Development to manage because they do have the expertise in housing. The other areas where We're providing grant funding to our recipients, and I'll get into that a little bit. Is economic development is one category that we've decided to fund, and examples of things under the economic development are extensions of publicly owned infrastructure that can serve industrial and commercial developments. We can acquire, develop, or construct improvements and otherwise improve real property. And we can establish economic development revolving loan funds that are actually managed at a local level so that they can use this revolving loan fund for their personal, for their individual projects that meet their goals on a local level. We also do microenterprise assistance.
Okay, before you go any further,
sure.
Senator Johnson, did she answer your question?
I think so.
Okay. Thank you. I dived right into it again.
There seems to be overlap, and if they're sub-granting a portion of HUD grants to the other department, you know, why is that necessary?
Mr. Chair, respectfully, I guess that's what I was sort of thinking as I was listening to Ms. Garrison talk. And also, I guess the test that I continue to use is, where do I look it up in the phone book? If I want to rehab a facility, multi-housing, low-income, multi-family housing, low-income, where do I start? How do I track the money? How many different sets of state folks do I have to go through between my idea and yes? And those are the things that I'm just trying to figure out.
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, on the housing rehabilitation and the housing center, what Housing and Community Services has done has been funding housing referral centers or service centers that do that referral as sort of a one-stop shop for housing services for affordable housing. And that's one of the things that we subgrant the funds to them to do because that really is their expertise. I think you've gotten a lot of letters of support from various constituents around the state saying, yes, housing is very important, but economic development, microenterprise assistance, these other things are very important also, and they do closely align with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department.
Where did the letters originate from?
You know, some of the letters originated from because right now there's a push at the national level to eliminate the community development block grant, the block grant program overall, and replace it with a different program. And so people are really paying attention to what's going on with community development block grant, and also wanting to save time in this committee hearing. We asked for a lot of written testimony instead of having a lot of public testimony.
Please send my best to them. They were very, very well informed on economic development in the state.
Thank you, Chair Smith. I'll do so.
Okay.
Senator Johnson, did that help answer the question a little bit?
A little bit.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'll see if I can answer a little bit more as I continue.
Thank you.
Another area that we focus on currently under what we call our 2005 method of distribution is the public works or infrastructure improvements. And examples of those are where we're doing improvements to the public water and wastewater systems to meet the Clean Water or Safe Drinking Water Acts. We're doing extension of publicly owned, what we call off-site infrastructure, to the affordable housing projects. We're doing brownfield redevelopment. We can do downtown revitalization. We also, another category is the public or community facilities.
Senator Johnson. Before you move, Ms. Garrison, to the public facilities, let me ask you a little bit about wastewater, because one of my communities has struggled with this. They end up not getting enough, a little tiny community, high unemployment. This community has no pharmacy, no grocery store. I mean, it's a little community, and their wastewater system has failed. And so they end up scurrying around. Nobody there has the expertise to really know how to do this. They scurry around to different places, and they end up trying to cobble together enough money from enough sources to make the project happen. And I'm trying to figure out what your philosophy in granting is. If the goal is to get clean water in a little community, why it is that it seems as though only a portion of the money comes from you all, and then the little community ends up making requests to our federal delegation for line item appropriations. And I'm just trying to figure out how we use our federal delegation the most effectively to speak to those projects that have the highest priority. I'm trying to figure out why, I mean, it throwing a life preserver only halfway out to the drowning person doesn't accomplish the goal. And I'm trying to figure out how you process a request from a community that says, we can't pass this on to our ratepayers. We've been told our system is failing. We're desperate. How do you process those?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, one of the very first things we do is when we first see that there's a community that has a need out there, we talk about the project. We bring in an application from them that has some financial information in it. We do a financial analysis on their past 3-plus years of audits to see if they could afford a loan. If it is a low or moderate income community, one of their first places is obviously going to be community development block grant. And each year there's a limit on the total amount of grant that any one project could get. In this past year, we've actually raised that grant limit because of that issue with many communities. These grant limits have stayed the same, like I think it was $600,000 or $750,000 for a water or sewer system, which in this day and age, you know, might be a drop in the bucket for what some of these systems cost. We've actually increased that to $1 million to try to help that situation. If they can afford a loan, they're usually offered a loan first. And the loan, the financial analysis for a loan does look sort of at average statewide rates. And some of those might be pretty high for a community, but we also need to have sort of what we call a fairness approach that, you know, one community isn't paying $30 a month or $40 a month, and another one, we give them more grant and they only have to pay $20 a month. So that's our first approach, and that we also recognize that these systems are very expensive, and we're trying to address that also. We do bundle a lot of our programs together, like the grant from the Community Development Block Grant might be able to reduce their rates enough to where they are affordable to be able to get a loan maybe from the Safe Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund or the Water Wastewater. Did that help answer the question?
Do you realize how technical this communication is right now?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, just step back here. And I want everyone in this room to realize this. When you take a small part-time city recorder, yep, in a small little rural community and you say, here's what we're going to do, and we take your conversation and we give that to them, do you know what happens to them? The light goes out. They don't understand it. Is there a way that we could work with the department and with our other partners to find a way to where we could hold their hand a little bit and walk, mm-hmm, them through the process? Mm-hmm. So rather than throwing them out fish, we can teach them to fish?
Chair Smith, yes. I think we do that well in many cases. I think we can do better. One of the highlights of the Community Development Block Grant Program is they can actually hire an administrator, so a qualified person that can help them walk through all the steps of getting the grant and managing the grant and the paperwork that's required, because it is a federal program, as they go along. Our staff also go out and do an immense amount of hand-holding, either on the phone, via email, or in person. Also, we're very close partners with the economic development districts around the state, and that's part of their mission, is to actually help the local communities that lack the capacity. Can we do more and do it better? Yes, I think we can, and one of the future directions of this program that I was going to talk about a little bit, but I can do it now by all means, is I think what we can do better is provide more training for our staff to make it simpler.
Let me interrupt that really quick.
Mm-hmm.
Let me begin by sharing with this committee, I think you do a fabulous job. I think the infrastructure programs you manage are very, very well run. But with that said, I also think they're very technical. And one of the things I'd like to just throw out to you is, what about the notion of creating an opportunity where small communities and small ports and small counties and small nonprofits could come together for a couple days and learn how to put together a package?
Mm-hmm.
They could learn how to put together an operating budget. They could learn how to conduct a public meeting. They could learn what are all the different funding sources and try and figure out how all those pieces fit together in one place where they have all the state folks there, and maybe bring in some of the more successful partners. We've got Mr. Roberts here in the audience with us, who's done a lot of successful projects. Bring him to these 3 or 4 day events and let him say, you know, here's some tricks to keep in mind. What would be wrong with that?
Chair Smith, there's nothing wrong with that except I'd be leery to duplicate what's already out there. I think there are a lot of programs that already do that. There's a week-long, very intense program that's called the Economic Development Institute in Ellensburg, Washington. There's a Ellensburg, Washington.
Okay.
It's a Pacific Northwest. We actually provide scholarships for our local partners to go there. There's another week-long institute in Boise that's, again, Pacific Northwest, that's called the Community Development Institute. And because this is so technical, I don't know that you could cover it all in 2 days. I think 2 days for each subtopic, and we do that also. We do hold trainings and seminars and workshops with our partners. Like,
what if we did 3 or 4 days?
I still don't think you could cover it all in 3 or 4 days. I think community development block grant in and of itself might be 3 and 4 days.
How does a part-time city reporter do it without 1, 2, 3, 4 days on their own back in a community?
Chair Smith, I think part of the answer there is the scholarships we provide. We can cover some of the training costs. All the training costs. We can cover the travel costs, which includes some of the lodging. The only thing that's left off the table is who does their job while they're gone. But we also go out and do one-on-one training and work group training on half day or full day out in the field. And that's one of the things I think we can do better with my staff and our partners like Department of Environmental Quality and Water Resources to get some of the information out to our partners.
Last question, then I'll move on. Do you think a small little city recorder is going to get the same level of hands-on guidance in Ellensburg, Washington, as they would in Redmond, Oregon, if we had an opportunity for folks to come and work with our own state partners, rather than working with economic development professionals from three states?
Chair Smith, I think they'd actually get a bigger benefit from going to Ellensburg, because with a mass of funding and people coming to one place, they can actually get highly expert people and speakers to come, whereas they might be stuck with me, who, you know, knows enough to be dangerous if it was in Redmond. So I actually think that the benefit through the Community Development Institute or the Economic Development Institute, where there's a lot of local rural folks there and they can trade best practices and do networking and have somebody to call down the road and say, hey, I need to do this. How did you get it done? I think that's the value there.
Thank you.
Sure. So we talked a little bit about the collaboration with the Housing and Community Services Department. And we've also talked about a little bit, have touched on the stakeholder involvement. Every year, one of the requirements of the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development is that we do informal and formal public hearings and input sessions. We hold those around the state, and we develop an annual method of distribution. The stakeholders and the public input we have gotten go throughout Oregon, both urban and rural areas. It includes all cities, counties, housing staff, and other service providers like the microenterprise service providers. I want to talk a little bit about the outcomes and results of this federal grant program.
Can you explain to the committee the microenterprise program? I'm unaware of what that is.
Now, that's where I'm going to get a little bit dangerous. But the microenterprise program is basically where we give a grant to either a collection of cities or regions or counties within a region to actually provide the technical assistance, the sort of advice and the business services support to owners, to this organization that will provide the technical support. They then in turn provide it to owners or people that are then trying to develop microenterprises. And I would assume that the definition of a microenterprise would be the federal definition and small, very small, 1-2 people type thing. But I could find that out for sure for you.
Yeah, help me with that, because is it microenterprise, is that referring to businesses?
The size of the business.
Yeah, can you?
Yeah.
So we can flush that out tomorrow?
Yes, okay. I can bring that back for you, no problem.
Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit about the outcomes and results of the funding that we do get from the federal government. So on an annual basis, we're able to provide funding for an average of about 43 projects. And over the last 4 years, that's averaged about 25 cities and about 11 or 25 counties and about 11 cities across the state on an annual basis. On an annual basis, we've also been able to benefit about 29,000 low and moderate income persons in the state. In addition, through the housing projects, they've been able to assist close to 200 low and moderate income households each year. We estimate that the construction jobs that are occurring from these various construction projects in public works and affordable housing are creating about 240 jobs in the construction trade each year. So the future direction that we're going with for the Community Development Block Grant is we're currently researching some other areas that are allowed under the federal law, the big umbrella, that Oregon currently does not avail itself of. We need to look closely at the pros and cons of those different areas because some of them might sound nice, but there's a whole bunch of federal strings that don't make them real easy to implement on the ground. We will convene a group of stakeholders and present those pros and cons because since we do manage this on behalf of the cities and counties, we want them to have that information in front of them as we all decide what the best use of future funding is from the community development and what categories that we should target those funds for.
What if the cities and counties came back and said, you know, we would like to have the state take a lead in helping us with training?
And we can do that now, Chair Smith.
But I mean, if they wanted to put together, if they came before us and said, you know, we'd like to have a 3-4 day training institute where you take the lead and bring in whoever you want to bring in and help them work through these.
Would you Chair Smith, I think we could do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Again, I think we'd want to look at the pros and cons and the other things out there and not duplicate the services, but if we could augment them or bring them closer to home in an efficient and effective manner, I think we'd all be open to that.
What if you wrote the script? I mean, literally said, here's our programs, here's what we have, here's, we know what your needs are, we know what it takes to get these things done, and you literally, you know, had your ERTs say, you know, community, you're not ready to undertake this project yet, you need to come to our training, and we're going to show you what it takes to be ready. Do you think you guys have the capability of doing that?
Chair Smith, one of the things that we really want to do in our future direction is to provide more training to my staff and also to our local recipients because some of these federal requirements are very complex.
Right.
And one of the things that we're looking into right now is what we're calling sort of a certified administrator's training. It wouldn't be mandatory by any means, but it would be logical training for real specific community development block grant requirements like the labor standards requirements or the land acquisition requirements that you have to read books, basically, you know, huge books to understand all the ins and outs of the federal requirements. And what we might be able to do with the Certified Administrators Program is then have a list of people that have been through the training, and they could continue to go back through the training as they'd like, and then cities or counties would have a list of people that would be qualified. It could be their own staff that's gone through the training, or it could be hiring an outside staff to help them through the project. And so that is one thing that we're embarking on right now. And whether it gets to a certified administrator status or it's just training modules, that is one of the things that we are working on right now.
Wouldn't that be exciting to be able to teach communities how to operate most efficiently
yep.
their facilities after they get them in the ground?
Chair Smith, that's basically what we're hoping. Because it's one thing to build the facility, especially if it's a community center, but how do you maintain it in the long run?
Very good point.
Yeah. So we do have many partners in the development, mostly the cities and counties. Sometimes they do apply on behalf of nonprofits in their region, such as in the microenterprise service delivery. I believe you do have many letters of support from various areas from the Southern Oregon or South Central Oregon Economic Development District, from the Eastern Oregon Professional Services Group, from the Oregon Coast Community College, from the Mid-Willamette Valley Council of Government, and from the Southern Oregon Women's Access to Capital. And I do have Mike MacArthur, the Executive Director of Oregon Association of Counties, here to talk later also about how important the Community Development Block Grant Program is.
How does the administration component of that work? You get 2%?
There's 2% of the funds that are a part of the community development block grant funds that we use for staff.
Okay.
And then there's additional 1% that, on top of that, that we can use for either staffing or the training, the technical, the capacity building type stuff. And we've, for the most part, used it for the capacity building.
So if I was a small community and I wanted to undertake a project, but I didn't know how to go about it, who do I contact at the department to get some TA dollars, technical assistance dollars, and can start a project?
Chair Smith, for the most part, any door in the department's a good door. We'll find the right person to talk to that community. Most of our divisions, at least the Community Development Division of Mike Burton's and mine, the Capital Projects, are organized on a somewhat geographic basis.
I'm sorry, I asked the question wrong. Which fund would you folks access to get technical assistance dollars to help the community?
Chair Smith, it would actually depend a little bit on the project, because some of the technical assistance funding through Community Development Block Grant is more for overall planning, like a strategic plan. It's not necessarily for, let's say, a feasibility study for one facility. Whereas there are some more specific planning infrastructure programs, especially, that are more targeted, and it can do a specific project, not an overall plan. So it really depends on what they're trying to do. And in some cases, we may not have the funding source to be able to help them. But we hope that we have a variety that we can help most of them.
Senator Berger?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Garrison, thank you for talking about outcomes. I think that's what we're all real interested in. Could you tell me what projects are attached to the 25,000 low and moderate income that you referred to in your outcome?
Chair Smith and Senator Verger, I can get you a list of every project that is funded and what each project, how many of those beneficiaries were associated with each project. I don't believe we've given that level of detail to you yet in any of the budget presentation information, but I can get that to you probably within a week.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair. I don't know that you need to go into lots of detail. That's just a large number of people mm-hmm. that you've helped through the Community Development Block Grant, and I didn't know whether you were including infrastructure to communities or whether you were just specifically talking about housing and grants and rehabilitation or, you know, just in general what is in that figure.
Chair Smith, Senator Verger, everything's in that. Everything that we can potentially do under Community Development Block Grant, all of those various categories, including housing, economic development, the public infrastructure, all of those projects have to report on their beneficiaries. And the majority of projects in Community Development Block Grant, the project has to meet 51% or low moderate income beneficiaries. So the number of beneficiaries is actually much greater than even this 29,000 number. That's only the low and moderate income beneficiaries that have been assisted by those projects. And we do have to report that on every single project to the Housing and Urban Development, so we have that information available if you'd like it.
That's not necessary. That's a very sufficient okay. answer. I was just trying to figure out exactly what was encompassed in it. Thank you.
Would you, for tomorrow, could you just bring us an application?
Chair Smith, I'd be happy to.
I'm a small city, and I was calling you saying I've got a water sewer. Mm-hmm. I need information. We just send it so the whole committee can just take a look at what's involved in a block grant.
Sure, Chair Smith, I'd be happy to. But one of the things I would just caution is we have a basic application form that collects the basic information everybody needs. You know, we need the contact, who's the highest elected official that's going to sign the contract, what your address, phone number, et cetera, is. For each individual program, then, we have supplements that we need to gather that information that will make sure that we address the statutory, the policy, and the programmatic requirements. And so you'll see some of those in the application. And we are trying to make those as simple and as English and as possible. We also have program...
I'll point out there, though, really quick for the committee, that that's federally driven. And so these applications will let the committee decide for themselves, but it's a federally driven program in which you're implementing, I assume, and a lot of the rules and regulations in there are as a result of what's going on in Washington, D.C.
Chair Smith, yes, there's many requirements that when the Community Block Grant was developed for a lot of these urban blighted areas in, you know, Chicago or New York, made a lot of sense. They don't necessarily make sense for rural Oregon. We do have to adhere to them, though. We try to help our applicants and our recipients jump over some of those hurdles because we know they have to do it, and we don't necessarily agree with it, but we have to do them too. And we do have program handbooks that help applicants fill out the application, and we also have handbooks that help them manage the project as they go along.
Would you bring those?
I would be happy to.
I think it'd be good for the committee just to see one of the projects.
It's going
to
be this big, but you'll get it.
That's right. That's why I bring a suitcase to my training that I go to. Thank you very much. Thank you. We're now going to get into small business programs. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Smith, subcommittee members. My name is Victoria Pruitt. I'm the Market Development Manager with OECDD, and I'm here to talk with you about small business, women, and minority programs. for the department. I am going to give you the abbreviated Cliff Notes version and move as quickly as I can. First off, I'm going to give you the definition for small business based on the Oregon Employment Department, which is businesses less than 200 employees that are manufacturing-based and all other businesses of less than 50 employees. In working with the Governor's Small Business Council, which is an 11-member volunteer council appointed by the governor, it consists of all small business owners from around the state. They have identified six key issues that have impacted small business. And one of the key threads under those issues that links all of them is the need for business and technical advice on various subjects concerning business, from insurance to sustainability. It's clear that small business needs qualified professional business services at strategic times in the life of the business. The challenge is identifying the need and providing the service at those important times. The legislature has recognized this and sees it as an economic development need and has tasked OECDD with supporting those needs. We utilize outside resources across the state to fulfill that directive. We partner with different groups, the SBDCs and some other targeted service providers that have a specialized focus for underserved populations, including women, minority-owned businesses. We leverage their expertise, their manpower, and their accessibility to business at the community level. The Small Business Development Center Network has 19 locations around the state, including an international trade office at Portland Community College. We have a long-established relationship with the SBDC network going back approximately 20 years. The Oregon SBDC network is a model of success around the United States and has been copied. They've given it, it gives it great ability that other states don't have because of the number of locations. And Bill Carter was before you on Small Business Day, and you saw some of the successes of some of those small business development centers on that day. OECDD is actually one leg of a three-leg stool in supporting small business for the SBDCs. The SBA funds them from the federal side. We fund them from the state side, and then the local institutions fund them as well. They are the primary channel for reaching small business owners throughout the state of Oregon. The other group we partner with is other targeted service providers. They touch on specific segments of small business needs throughout the state. We actually go through a competitive RFP process to contract with those providers. And most businesses seeking counseling won't even know that the department's been involved. We're using those outside service providers on the ground in the communities to reach small business. Different providers serve different segments and often separate business needs. The SBDCs are they're the broad brush stroke. They're reaching small businesses all across the state. They do target women-owned businesses fairly well. They reach businesses with employees of 10 or fewer, and many of those are actually 6 or fewer. And the average wage is approximately $25,000. They're primarily retail and service sector-based businesses. Some fall into the traded sector category as well. The other targeted service providers specialize in certain specific segments, and that's why we contract with them. I'm going to name some of those because they all deserve to be recognized, and we do have a couple of them here to speak with you today. OAMI, the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs. Unfortunately, Sam Brooks couldn't be here with us today. I don't know if Tom is going to read his letter, but hopefully he will. Tom Hampson from ONABIN, which is the Oregon Native American Business and Entrepreneurial Network. He's been involved in economic development in the state for quite some time. OMEP, which you've heard about, Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership. I recognize them here. They're funded out of another source, but we consider them one of our targeted providers. GCAP, the Government Contract Assistance Program. OMEN, the Oregon Micro Enterprise Network. Again, that was funded through CDBG, but we see them as a targeted service provider, and we contract and support them as a partner in that way. HDC, the Housing Development Center. The Hispanic Metro Chamber of Commerce. Interface Network, which is also targeted towards the Hispanic community. And we have Esther Puentes and a minority business owner here to speak with you, Marco Alvarado. East County One Stop and Cascadia Revolving Fund are all targeted service providers that the department contracts with. At the direction of the legislature...
Really quick, Victoria. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. This is less a question to you than it is to the professional staff and the chair. We've just heard a lengthy description of your targeted service providers, and I believe in one of the attachments that was provided to the committee, you had a list of some of the folks that are the recipients of agency money to go out and provide these services. Was that an exhaustive list? What I'm looking for, and this is really not a question to you, but to the agency or the professional staff of the chair, where do we get the entire list of all of the contracted fee for service or the direct appropriations that come through the agency to providers of various and sundry nature,
mm-hmm.
all in one place, all together?
That, what I would share is that was kind of the question we have been working with. And what I would ask is whoever we need to in the audience, if this committee can get an all-inclusive list of who the department contracts with.
Without parsing fund type or service provided or geography, I want the entire list of everybody.
Should be a computer readout.
An inclusive list of everyone the department has a contract.
Consultants, right. Companies.
That's right.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lynn Beaton. I'm the manager of the Central Operations Division. We've heard you ask the question. We want to make sure we do understand it. So you're not just talking about when we contract for a service to the department, which is how we usually refer to contracting services, as if we hire somebody to do a survey for the department specifically or something like that. You're talking about even if we're giving money out and then it's targeted out further, you would like that list as well.
That's what I want.
Yeah,
right?
Okay.
I want anyone that you both sign on the line and someone else signs on the line. We want a list of that.
Secondary and tertiary.
Understand. Thank you.
This is the ultimate follow the money.
Yes, so it is. I'm hearing that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we will do the best we can, but I feel I very clearly understand the question. So we'll see what we can do for you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to interrupt your testimony. You just provided the vehicle by which to nuance the request, so thank you.
Chairman Smith, Senator Johnson, I'm happy to accommodate you. I'm going to briefly touch on the Small Business Survey, which is how we evaluate the services that are rendered across the state. But an email was sent to you and a link to that survey so that you could look at it directly approximately a week ago. So I'm going to kind of let the survey stand on its own. But essentially what we're tasked with doing is performing a survey annually, and this was directed by the legislature, to evaluate those services. We take a survey of approximately 10%, survey those people, and ask them what the impact has been to their businesses based on the services received.
10% of?
Whatever pool we're given, we're looking for a statistically sound 10% response. Okay. For people participating.
You take all of the different partners and get 10% of that?
Yes.
So
Chair Smith, yes.
Thank you.
And Chair Smith and subcommittee, to refer you, if you wanted to check that link, you'd notice approximately we got names for 5,600 people who'd been serviced by the providers. They provided us with the names since the last survey. By the time we whittled it down and had all the people participating, we had about 575, which we considered to be a statistically sound sample.
Question?
Okay.
Representative Richardson.
Just on that, is that a digital survey using internet, or are you still using pages and pages of paper and stamps and hoping that they mail it back and that kind of thing? Or is it phone call?
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, it is actually a phone-based survey. We found that that is the most productive, and then you can pick up on the nuances and ask the questions that you need to ask. We're asking questions of people who are also Hispanics, Asians, minorities, that you may need to understand what some of those nuances are and how they communicate so that we can get accurate responses and as clear-cut responses for the survey as possible.
You've heard one of the concerns the last time you folks were with us, and that was the timing of the survey.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a chance to think through that? Were we wrong in assuming that a couple days before the election is an okay time to make a phone call to someone's home?
Yeah. Chair Smith, subcommittee members, the timing of the survey has actually been historically dictated. We do it at that point and timing and within the year so that those service providers can get as many people helped and served to be evaluated, because then they're scaled on that. And as we look into the next year, we're looking at their performance based on that survey. So
I think it'd be to your detriment, though, to hold it at that period of time and not...
Well, if we had held up, we potentially wouldn't have had results to have conferred with our partners and then also to report it to you. And that's where we're bound to report, I believe, by the end of the year.
10 days later.
So we started in early October, and we actually had some holdups with the survey based on a list that we weren't quite sure the list was accurate. So we were delayed approximately 2 weeks. But we had started in early October.
The survey, just trying to, a couple of us on the committee feel like that date isn't the best date. Is there just a way to move it so it's not at election time where... At least I know in my district.
You're wasting your money.
Yeah.
You're going to have phone calls from folks.
Yeah, Representative Smith, Representative Richardson, we will look at that, and we will make accommodations for that in years where we have elections.
On the survey, how is that paid for?
Chairman Smith, subcommittee members, it's actually a piece of the total budget. Since it's requested and directed by the legislature. When we get to the budget line, which I'll actually just move there now because I want to try and get finished here. The budget line for small business is $3.1 million. 2.2 of that is to the SBDC network, and they distribute those funds to the different locations around the state. $900,000 goes to targeted service providers. $25,000 of that is set aside to do the survey.
How much?
$25,000.
So how much was the survey in its entirety?
Chair Smith, I didn't see the final invoice on this one. I can refer to Ron to see if he has a number. But I wouldn't know that. Chair Smith, subcommittee members, I've just been corrected, and I was told it was paid out of admin, but we will get the dollar amount for the survey from you.
Well, my understanding is that HOMA and SBDCs and, I'm sorry, I don't have my notes in front of me, several other folks all contributed to that, financially contributed to that survey. And so it didn't come out of admin, it came out of their budgets.
Chairman Smith, members of the committee, again for the record, I'm Ron Fox, the manager of the Business Development Division. We instituted this survey process about 3 years ago, and at that point in time, we did use a portion of the $3.9 million to fund that survey. In this most recent survey, we just pulled those funds from an administrative fund for professional services, so we did distribute the full $3.1 million, as Victoria mentioned, $2.2 million to the SBDCs and the $900,000 to the targeted service providers, and funded the survey costs from our own agency administrative funds, ostensibly just for the reason that you might ask, to deliver $3.9 million worth of services to Oregon small businesses. So we've been doing the survey, I think, as she mentioned, 3 years, and we've realized that it was a more effective way to fund it from administrative costs. We use a request for proposal survey to select the survey company, competitive solicitation.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we have a conversation and have you folks walk through that with me? Just so.
We're happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
we're
talking about surveys on your sheet. You know, we talked about the fact that it took place just before election and all of those concerns, and yet what your conclusion is here, whoever wrote this, is we conclude that we are over-surveying small businesses utilizing these programs and thus recommend a change to a biannual survey requirement. And in our position is that it may not be over-surveying at all. It may be the fact that your timing was bad if it's a week before an election. And so not that we need to have an annual survey. I mean, maybe biannual is fine, but I think that to say that small businesses feel that it's just over-surveying may not be a realization of other factors involved with the survey.
Chairman Smith, Representative Richardson, the recommendation, there's actually a recommendation that was presented to us by the consultant who has actually done the survey, I believe, 3 years for us. And the feeling was that because of the overlap in surveying businesses, we were reaching out to some businesses and who have received multiple services and surveying them twice, and they'd say, well, you just surveyed me. So that was the recommendation that was provided by the consultant. So it's something I think in the interim we would want to talk with our the small business development centers and our targeted service providers to improve on that technique, timing being one of those, as well as the whether we get additional data value from surveying once every 12 months, or whether we could achieve meaningful results, report our outcomes on doing it every 2 years. And it gives the small businesses a longer time to implement the recommended business services they get from the service providers. It's sometimes difficult to make those changes happen in a short period of time for the business.
Sandra Berger.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How flexible do you feel that you've been? Let's just talk about small business with big box stores and internet sales. The shopping public has totally changed. Have we changed in the way we help small business stay in business in that environment? If you drive around Oregon, you see the high vacancy rates. You see the closed stores. It doesn't matter which town you go in. You see all these empty buildings that are sitting there. There are businesses going out of business that have been there for years. Small bookstores, for instance, that are trying to compete because of internet sales. So I'm just wondering, would you address how flexible you've been in changing your strategy with small business?
Sure. Chairman Smith, Senator Merger, since I've had a little bit longer experience with the small business service within the department, I'll try to give an answer and let Victoria respond as she may. I think the answer to your question is yes. One of the things that we discuss with the small business developments, and in fact, a couple of years ago, we actually provided some funding that helped them develop internet business sales techniques to help small businesses improve their ability to sell their goods and services through the essentially what amounts to a global internet, since companies here in Oregon are selling their products anywhere in the world over the internet. I know the Small Business Development Centers, Bill Carter from the network can probably elaborate on this additionally, but they are constantly updating their services that they provide to small businesses to improve their assistance in form of accounting and banking knowledge, marketing techniques, outreach, the various things that you mentioned in terms of competing in a market that is continuously more competitive, and particularly more competitive on a global basis. So I think that is going. Additionally, I would say that in the survey results, there are some good information that is gathered from those small businesses that are interviewed that gives us some direction to take in the next biennium in terms of how we would ask our service providers, both the small business centers and those providers that target the minority and women-owned business, to shape their services to meet the needs that are identified by those small businesses as most valuable and most needed going forward.
Thank you. And I follow up, Mr. Please. Chair, and I didn't mean to imply that you didn't do it. I was just curious.
That's how we do it.
Whether you did it or not. I think that I guess what I'm trying to get at is that a lot of times when people are in a small business with a very limited staff, they aren't really sure of what they should do as far as maintaining better efficiencies, how to reorganize the space that they're using so that it looks like they can expand, actually, by adding more product. That's the kind of just practical business plan that I'm thinking of. And a lot of times that requires a consultant or a person that's very specialized in their particular kind of business. Let's take a restaurant business. That would mean that a person coming in might decide that the food isn't as good. So there needs to be some analysis of that. And I just don't want us to be spending money, and I know you don't want it either, in more or less spinning our wheels in things that aren't being productive in small business. And I don't have all the answers because the world has changed rapidly and the shopping of people has changed. But I will tell you that in my area of the coast, people flock to Charleston to shop.
And this is a small fishing village, but it has a different atmosphere than a mall. Mm-hmm. Because if you get in a mall, you don't know which city you're in. And so there's an attractiveness that small business can really highlight if they know how to do it. And so thank you very much for your response.
Chair Smith and subcommittee members, I'd like to just do a brief addition to what Ron had to say, which is that the SBDCs are actually looking at technical assistance to small businesses and looking at an SBTDC model, potentially where there's a lot more technology base going into the different centers across the state. I believe Bill Carter has also made a proposal at the national level to do a test of an e-SBDC, which would be an online version, so that people could be accessing information online. From a personal approach, business goes through cycles. In those big boxes, people are going to end up wanting to reach out and touch again and essentially find that community base. So business all goes through cycles.
I think you're right.
Let's share with the committee a couple budget questions related to small business. With the small business development centers, what percentage of the state's funding is used to fund SBDCs?
Out of the 3.1, it's 2.2. Okay.
Of the overall SBDC funding, what percent does the state
As far as I know for OECD, that's our piece. I don't know the SBDC network's total funding base. I know that we're the match for their federal dollars. And I do know
what federal dollars are.
I'm not sure if it's matched one for one. I can find that out for you. And I know that Bill is sitting here, so if he's going to be doing any testimony, Bill Carter, who's the head of the SBDC network, could comment on that.
Let me quick. It's important to understand that if you look at the Bush administration's allocation for small business programs,
mm-hmm.
a lot of programs in which the state in the past may have been eligible to try and leverage dollars from have been zeroed out.
Yes, sir.
But the SBDCs are funded at $88 million.
Mm-hmm.
Has the department taken a look at that?
Chair Smith and subcommittee members, I do know that from the federal side, it's held flat for approximately 6 years. I'm not sure where that's going, you know, in the next biennium. And I do know that for local universities and the local funding from the institutions that they receive, that has been diminishing greatly.
Do you folks contract? Who do you contract with on the SBDCs? Do you contract with all 19 centers?
Chair Smith, subcommittee members, no. Yes, we contract with the SBDC network, and they disperse the funds from there.
Okay, so the state contracts to a network. Where's the network located?
Chair Smith and subcommittee members, it's based in Eugene.
Okay, and so then the director in Eugene then works with who? They have 19 centers, and those are located with colleges and universities?
Chair Smith and subcommittee members, there are 19 locations around the state. 3 are university-based, the rest are community college, and then there's one that's an international center that's based at Portland Community College.
So just so I can follow this, because it's important to follow the money. So the legislature appropriates to economic development.
Mm-hmm.
Economic development through DAS contracts with the SBDC network.
Correct.
Contract with, I assume, Lane Community College?
Pardon me?
I assume it's Lane Community College?
Chair Smith, I believe that's where he's housed.
Okay. And then from there, the network director would contract with those entities, and then those entities would hire who they would like to administer and run their SBDCs.
Chair Smith, I believe that's how the system is run, yes.
Does the state of Oregon hire any SBDC directors?
Chair Smith, no.
Okay, thank you.
Question?
Representative Richardson.
Just as you continue this discussion of SBDCs, a notice from Representative Boquist saying that the community college in his district is about to lose their SBDC connection, and I'm not sure what's going on. I mean, I can go pull that up. You know what I'm talking about.
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, I don't have any news of that, but if we want to, I can get you some more information, or, again, if Bill Carter has the opportunity to give some testimony, I'm sure he could clarify that for you as the head of that network.
Thank you.
I really, really appreciate the work that the governor and your office does for small business in the state of Oregon. It represents about 98%, 96%, depending upon who you talk to, of all businesses in the state of Oregon. And sometimes I, as the chair of this committee, feel like they're ignored. And I truly appreciate the fact that you've come before us and you've talked about the importance of small business to Oregon's economy. Yeah. So thank you.
In quick wrap up, I'd like to add to that and add the other pieces that OECD does in supporting small business. We've got the SBDCs and those targeted providers. We also have the business finance programs, which are all targeted towards small business, and we have 12 business development officers that are in the communities working with businesses on a daily basis, and 85% of their calls throughout the year are to small businesses located in Oregon. Thank you.
Do you want to move to the finance programs next, or do you
actually
do you want to do that tomorrow?
I've been given a note here.
Yeah, come on up.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lynn Beaton for the record. Given the time right now, what we would be recommending is that we postpone Victoria's testimony explaining the business finance programs till tomorrow, but let all the invited testimony come forward now so they have a chance, including the two people who wanted to speak to that program, if you're comfortable
with
that.
That's perfect.
Okay.
That's perfect.
Thank you.
Victoria, great job. We appreciate that. Why don't we move to the let's see here. We're not going to go to public testimony yet. We're going to go to the invited testimony. Let me find my agenda. Let's see here. Do you have that extra agenda?
Use mine?
There we go.
Oh, you had some arrows.
Yeah.
Okay. Chair Smith, members of the committee, since I was the first program, I'm going to take prerogative and get my invited guests. Again, I wanted to just quickly, and I'll let them introduce themselves in greater detail. Patrick Murphy, who is the executive director for the Oregon Manufacturers Extension Partnership, and Tom Wright Hay from the Burley Group, the Burley Co-op. And they'll talk additionally on the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, their delivery of lean manufacturing, manufacturer productivity assistance as a part of our industry sector outreach fund that I spoke earlier to. So I'll turn it over to them.
Perfect. Really quick, gentlemen, and for everyone in the audience, we're approaching 3 p.m., and at that time you may see several committee members have to get to other places. I will stay here as long as it takes, and I will make sure that a transcript gets to each of the members. And I can assure you most of these members, because they have no other life as well, see this on public access television in the evenings, and we'll make sure that the comments get shared. So please don't take offense if you see members leaving. Welcome.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name for the record is Patrick Murphy. I'm director of the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership. And my only intent today was to introduce Tom Wright Hay, who is Chief Operating Officer of Burley Design Cooperative in Eugene, and of course answer questions, including Senator Morris's, but I think his testimony may answer in part about the engagement in the FEED process. So, Tom?
Members of the committee, or Chairman Smith and members of the committee, my name is Tom Wright Hay. I'm CEO and General Manager of Burley Design Cooperative based in Eugene, Oregon. What I'd like to do is give you a little bit of background on our company and the situation that we got into that led us to involvement with OMEP, and talk about the lean manufacturing project and implementation that we're going through. We're a manufacturer and marketer of bicycles and bicycle accessories. Our primary product is a bicycle trailer that you use to tow behind your bike and take your kids with you. We've been in business for 30 years, approximately. 26 is a worker-owned cooperative, and we made that switch about 1978. Like I said, two-thirds of our revenues are related to bicycle trailers. Approximately 75% of our revenues is domestically based, and the rest of it comes from exports, primarily to Europe. About 100 people working for us, and 60 of those are members, actually owners of the cooperative, and the remainders are the 40 or so folks are employees and seasonal workers. There's been a lot of change in the manufacturing environment in the United States, and as you know, a lot of manufacturing has been sourced overseas, primarily to Asia. The bicycle industry is no exception. Starting about 1995-96, there was a dramatic shift in the amount of domestic production versus the amount of imports coming in from foreign producers, and that's affecting the industry in the form of price competition. As you know, I think Senator Berger mentioned about changing consumer habits. People want a better deal. They want the high-end product for ever-decreasing price, and that's the situation we're faced with in the bicycle industry. You can get our primary product, the high-end Delight bicycle trailer, retails for about $430. You can get that, an equivalent product, for about $200 cheaper. You buy it at Walmart. It's an equivalent product. It's not the same quality, but the consumer doesn't necessarily know. And so there's some challenges on our side in terms of marketing and distribution that we're dealing with. But going back to the manufacturing side, we're faced with competing against manufacturers who are much less expensive than we are because their labor rates over in Asia and so forth, $2 an hour, $3 an hour, et cetera. So when I got this job in June 2003, I recognized the need to change our manufacturing operation. It was very inefficient. We had been doing things for the same kind of manufacturing processes for about 20 years. And as we grew, we introduced new products, and so the complexity of the product line increased dramatically, above and beyond our ability to manage it. And there's some other reasons for that that I won't go into today, but if you're happy to know about those, we can talk about those later, I guess. So our manufacturing operation needed to be improved, and I was really at a loss as to how to do it. I'm an engineer by undergrad, but I've never had to deal with a manufacturing operation like this. And so I was in the process of looking for a consultant to help us out with our production management. And one day, Bob Warren from the local chapter of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department came in and just wanted to interview me, get to know me, get to know a little bit about Burley's business, and started mentioning some of the services that he was tied into. And he mentioned OMEP. And I literally had to stop myself from jumping over at the desk to get to this guy because I was desperate for production help. And conversations with Bob Warren led us to OMEP, and specifically John Valkovic, who is our lean manufacturing consultant, came in, and we were only supposed to meet for an hour, but we ended up talking for 4 hours. It was a wonderful conversation. As a worker-run cooperative, we're a very unique culture. We have a very unique culture. And somebody who's a traditional consultant can't just come in and help us out. We need a specific kind of individual. And my worst fear is that we were going to get some guy coming in with a pocket protector, and it would not be a cultural fit. And I'm an engineer, so I can make those kinds of references. Luckily, John Valkovic was a wonderful fit. He's got a ponytail, and so he's a wonderful fit for our organization, and very technically very knowledgeable, and was able to help us. And he was a wonderful fit with the organization. We had to figure out a way to pay for that, and then we got hooked up with the Governor's Workforce Training Fund, specifically administered by the Lane Workforce Partnership in Eugene. So we got funding for that for about $66,500. We have a match that we have to provide, and it's basically opportunity cost, how much of our time and energy and labor is put into the project. We don't have a specific cash outlay as part of the grant. The process that we went through to get through lean manufacturing, and I'm going to explain what we think of lean manufacturing in a minute, but the process that we went through is we sent everybody in the organization through what we call Lean 101. And basically what you do is run a mock factory for a day. So it's an 8-hour session. You inherit a factory, and there's trash everywhere. The process isn't very well laid out and so forth. And you run it, and it doesn't work. And then the consultants, John Valkovic and another guy, spoon-fed us lean manufacturing concepts. And we start with some basic level lean concepts. And then we go back and revise the production line and try it again. And you repeat this process 3 times, and at the end of the day, they give you a canned solution. And the performance improvement, same workforce, same equipment basically, the performance improvement during the course of the day is dramatic. It shows what you can do when you work smarter and more efficiently. So that was the first phase. The second phase was taking project teams. We did 3 projects, one for our bicycle manufacturing operation, one for our trailer assembly area, and one for our sewing operation. And essentially, these 3 project teams are going through and redesigning the production processes in their areas. We're also working on the administrative side. We've got another consultant from OMEP, Chris Shear, who's helping us out with our administrative processes. So we're really approaching the whole organization. The improvements that we've been able to realize, I mean, it's still a little early to tell. We've really been, there have been improvements in flow and so forth. Profitability is going to take a year or so to fully realize. But the improvements that we're making, product is flowing more smoothly. Before, I can't describe very politely the kind of chaos that existed in our production operation. but it was very problematic. We couldn't get product to the customer in time. And so what we've been able to do is dramatically improve the flow through the plant. People are starting to say things, you know, it's completely different from last year. They said this thing and they made that comment in January. We'd only really been in the lean implementation mode for about 3.5 months. People are also saying things are running so smoothly. Are we missing something? It's completely changed, and we've only, up until January at that time, we'd only been doing it for about 3.5 months. The time before that was spent in training. So we're on our way. We're just getting started, but some of the other improvements real quickly, morale's improved. There's more cohesion. In any organization, as you know, there's a silo effect, and so you've got the sewing team fighting with the bike team, fighting with the trailer shop, and that's been dramatically minimized. We're actually more cooperative now than we have been in the previous 10 or 15 years. Like I said, we're just getting started. This is a process of continuous improvement, to use a buzzword. We're going to create a better way of doing things at Burley, and then that's going to be the launching point for the next way of doing things. And the idea is to get the organization used to constant change, planned constant change, because the competitive environment is not static. It's constantly moving. So as soon as we figure out to offer a better product or service to our customers, our competition is going to be doing the same thing. So we have to be a moving target. We have to stay one step ahead of our competition, and that's this process that we're going through. We were fortunate to have the governor visit us to check on our progress about a month and a half ago. That was a wonderful visit. Glenda Poling from the Lane Metro Partnership. She had visited us with Jack Roberts earlier before we had gotten started on the process. And as we were going through the tour with the governor, she pulled me aside and said, "Oh my God, things are, what happened here? It's completely different." So that was a good compliment. The governor was pleased with our progress, and we actually, the most important group, our customers are pleased, and then we're pleased as well, because it's a lot less hectic, and we're going to be able to do a lot more in the coming years with this.
I have a question.
Yes.
Representative Richardson.
Tom, it sounds like a great utilization of available services. You've been in business 20 years?
30 years.
30? What kind of gross revenue do you have in your business?
Chair Smith and Representative Richardson, we're about a $9 million company right now.
Okay. And you were looking for help at the time that you found this process. And yet it sounds like all of the benefit that you've received has been funded by taxpayers in Europe, a profit-making venture. Why would it be appropriate for the taxpayers to bear 100% of the benefit that you received in doing this to your business when you're making $9 million gross revenue?
Our profitability is very minimal. In fact, in 2003, we had a loss. And so we couldn't have afforded to do this on our own. Chair Smith and Representative Richardson, members of the committee, as a worker-owned cooperative, we're unlike a traditional organization. Another organization, a more traditionally organized organization, would get capital investment from outside sources. As a worker-owned cooperative, we're not really in that mode. The folks that work there own a share of the business. And it's unlikely that an outside investor would come in and want to have just one share, one vote, the way we're structured. And so somebody who's going to come in and invest a chunk of money in us is going to want a greater stake in the operation than our culture and the way we're set up would allow them to have. So our structure doesn't allow that kind of outside investment as typical of other organizations. So, and again, we couldn't afford it on our own, and you know, we're thankful that we've had the opportunity to work with OMEB.
Okay, thank you.
We appreciate this. Thank you very much.
And real quick, Chair Smith and Representative of the Committee, if you're interested in learning more about lean manufacturing, there's a book called The Toyota Way by Jeffrey Liker. It will explain, it's a very wonderful read. It'll explain what lean's all about, because you're going to start seeing more of it in the state.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to actually call up Mr. Roberts, a former labor commissioner, and kind of move you on up here, and then I'm going to allow folks who have traveled from a far distance to come up. So, Mr. Roberts. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm executive director of the Lane Metro Partnership, which you heard referred to a few minutes ago. It's great to see all of you again in person, although, of course, I saw Representative Richardson on Hardball last night, so that was an unexpected pleasure. The Lane Metro Partnership is a private nonprofit that was formed 20 years ago this year by the cities of Eugene, Springfield, by Lane County, and the Eugene-Springfield Chambers of Commerce. You recall back in the mid-80s, we were trying to crawl our way out of the recession of the early 80s, and the idea was that on a regional basis, we can work better to try to attract businesses as well as help retain businesses and help them expand. 20 years later, as we're trying to get out of this most recent recession, we're doing the same thing. We're similar to a lot of other organizations throughout the state that deal in the local level of nonprofits, and you've heard from some earlier today. I want to talk a little bit, if I may, about three recent examples we have working on some projects with the Economic Development Department that were extremely beneficial for our community, and give them as an example of how I think this partnership can and should work. I understand that the Economic Development Department does a lot more than just the things that we work with them on. Also, that the relationships that we have and what we've developed may not exist everywhere in the state, and therefore I'd like to talk about how I think this is really the model that works best. The first one, which again I think Steve Vincent mentioned earlier, was Royal Caribbean Cruise Line, which was looking for a West Coast center. It's a 165,000 square foot building, about $65 million investment. We have 1,000 employees when it's filled up, and it did choose to come actually to Springfield, not Eugene. I would get in big trouble if I didn't get that straight. But if you have a chance to come down to our community on I-5, just before you get to the Beltline interchange and look over to the left, you'll see the area where they're now in the process of building that. They've leveled the field and are putting some things up, and it's going to be a great building. That was a competitive bid. They were looking at a number of different sites. Finally came down to us versus Spokane. And had it not been for our partnership with the Economic Development Department and, frankly, with the governor, it wouldn't have happened. Mr. Vincent pointed out the governor's strategic reserve fund was extremely important. There were other things that we also did that were important in terms of providing some advantages. One advantage we also had just in terms of our business climate that we often don't think about was our tax structure. Because one of the advantages they had here they didn't have in Spokane is that we don't have a sales tax. Now, for this type of a business, you don't normally think about a sales tax as being important. But up in the state of Washington, they not only have a very high sales tax, I think it was state and local would have been about 8%, but they would have had to pay it on their new construction. And so their construction costs, which, again, they're talking about a $65 million building, they would have had to pay that. Interesting side note, they exempt up their manufacturing. But they had a bill in the previous session legislature to exempt the sales tax on call centers, and it was tied up in committee and didn't get out. And to show how competitive this gets, they actually had a letter from them saying that in their next session, all the candidates for governor, the legislative leadership of both parties all signed on saying, we will get this passed next session. And when they asked me whether I thought that was impressive, I said yes, but if they had the public employee union sign on, it might have been more impressive, because I had a feeling that's why I got stuck in committee last time. So that's an example of the kind of things when we talk about how tax structure affects it. It's important. In our state, we have done some things that have made us more competitive. I know one of the things they were interested in then was our movement toward the single sales factor, and that was something they looked at and said that's going to have a positive impact for them. So we were able to succeed in that working with the Economic Development Department. Then, so the other end of the job market, we also have an existing company there, a homegrown company by the name of Molecular Probes. It's a biotech company. They make these very sophisticated fluorescent dyes that are used for diagnostic and research purposes. It is, I believe, the largest biotech employer in the state of Oregon. It has about 250 employees, high-end, a lot of them scientists, PhD, and they were bought by a global biotech company, Invitrogen. And our immediate fear was that they were going to buy out their patents, buy their research, shut them down. And instead, and this is another case where Bob Warren, who you heard referred to earlier, is our business development officer, and I went out and met with them, talked to them about their plans, found that they really wanted to stay there, and we were able to put together a package that helped not only keep them there, but to get them to buy their buildings, which did not go with the company, invest another more than $15 million in upgrading their chemistry lab, adding more than 100 new employees, half of whom will be masters and PhD, and create a training center and other things there that would be attract people and events there and help make it a magnet for the biotech community. There's another case where we got the governor to...
Senator Johnson.
Sorry.
I may be jumping ahead of you. Tell me how you put the package together. What all elements were there, and did you shepherd it through from the start of the package to the completion of the package?
I worked with the Economic Development Department, particularly with our local business development officer, but also with the folks at the people at the top level of the Economic Development Department were involved in that and putting it together. What the package involved in the case of molecular probes was strategic reserve, regional investment fund from the Regional Investment Board of Lane County, Linn County, Benton County, and Lincoln County. Our county commissioners and the media lottery money they had put together. So the total package there was about $950,000. We then had another $500,000 that's available for some training funds once they've sort of put this together to try to get people trained. Obviously, you're not going to do a lot of training of the PhD and the master's people, but among the things we're going to use it for is that training center they have is going to enable them to train their sales force for the products of the molecular probe cells that will help deal with that. So the total package was about $1,450,000, and that was something that we worked with the Economic Development Department to put together. It was a state and local package with participation. And another interesting side note is that the challenge there, they had already made the decision to stay there, but trying to get that improvement package and that expansion high on the list of the capital improvement plans for Invitrogen, who has plants all over the world, was our real competition. And they finally ended up funding two of them, ours and one in New York. They happened to be almost exactly the same size, same employment numbers. The difference was we put $1.45 million on the table. They put $13 million on the table. Now, I don't think any of us expect to be able to compete with New York, but it is an example every once in a while of what we're competing against. But again, that helped us to put that all together and have a package that moved us up in their list to make that happen. It's in the process of taking place right now.
Really, really quick, we have a question here.
Mr. Roberts, before we go any further, a minute ago you said they'd already decided they were going to stay there, but...
But their expansion to get another 100 jobs and to make the new investment and upgrading it, that was they had to compete with other areas. I think they had already looked here and they decided they liked this area. They weren't going to shut down and just leave. So the retention part, which was our original concern, probably we didn't have to put this on the table to make that happen. We did have to put that on the table to get them to go to the next level, build the new chemistry lab, add 100 new employees, and those things, put that together. Then also, obviously, while the decision right now to shut down had already been made, they weren't going to do that. The more they invest, the more they do, the harder it's going to be then for them to pull up roots and leave in the future. So there was a retention element to that. But the expansion and the growth beyond that, we really did have to compete with their other sites. I think they had other sites in Maryland and Madison, Wisconsin, other places that were looking, trying to get on in the queue. And so I understand that we were one of the two that they selected to go forward with.
Please. Mr. Chair, Mr. Roberts, we're concerned about OECD's budget and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So would you explain what participation OECD had that made a difference in this expansion arriving? In other words, if the OECD wasn't there, would you still have been able to have ended up with the same conclusion?
We worked through OECD to get the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund and believe that was significant in accessing that. Also, of course, working with them through the RIB, which comes through them, and working it. But also in terms of designing this package, figuring out what is available, identifying how we do that, and working together in a partnership with them, that helped us to decide what can we put on the table that has the best chance of being successful. And that's where OECD, working together with us in a partnership, we think put together the package that was successful. We also brought down, at that time, the deputy director visited with them. We were able to show them what our plans and our programs were for trying to promote that part of the industry. That was a targeted industry cluster for the state of Oregon. A lot more was going on with OHSU up in the Portland area. That's one of the other things they were interested in, but that's where the partnership came in. The same thing was true with the Royal Caribbean, and there we put in strategic reserve and workforce training money. We also did some things with the city of Springfield, who vacated a road and dedicated the land to them to make that possible. So again, it's all this partnership, but it's working with them in a partnership, being able to get the approval. They're the ones who worked with the governor to make that happen and put that package together.
Please, Mr. Chair, Ms. Roberts, You said that we were, Oregon, you were involved in, is it one point, what million dollars was being offered?
For molecular probes, the total was 1,450,000, just under 1.5 million.
And was that from the strategic?
No, the strategic reserve was, and we had to keep bumping this up again. We were trying to tie into some special public works money and other things, but we couldn't find a way to fit it into the project. Ended up being $700,000 strategic reserve, and then we added 250,000, 150,000, I believe it was from the RIB, and 100,000 from Lane County, or those could have been reversed, but the total was 250,000 from the local and regional sources.
Okay, just kind of follow up. You said New York had 13 million. Why did they not? I mean, what was it that made them stay if it wasn't 12 million bucks?
They did both. They did the New York project and ours. So you were at the top two. What I was saying is that sort of shows the level where we're competing. If they had to choose between the two, I think it might have been tough. Okay. Although, and I want to be clear about this, incentive packages are never the total reason. The economic fundamentals are important. This happens to be a company that is a real crown jewel for them. This has a global reputation, and so there are a lot of reasons why they wanted to do this. But in terms of deciding, are we going to do it or not do it here, that incentive package was important. It also is important in that it shows our commitment to helping them be successful. And it's an indication of good faith on the part of the local community, which I think sometimes we tend to underestimate. They're looking for tangible signs. Everybody can give them the good words, but they want to know, if you're willing to put money on the table, that means that next year you're not likely to turn around and try to make life difficult for us on some other issue.
In your opinion, what do you think helps the department? What's the guiding principle for the department in determining who gets strategic reserve and who doesn't?
They're the ones really got to answer that question. I'll tell you what my impression is that, number one, they're looking at how many jobs are going to be created, what's the quality of those jobs, are those jobs in what we're now thinking of in terms of targeted industry clusters that have the best chance to grow and expand in the future. If you had someone who said, we have a great opportunity to create some jobs here, but it's going to be an isolated industry, there aren't a lot of others, suppliers aren't here, there's not going to be a lot of, and another one is there in an area that's growing and that's doing real well, which is actually the other one I want to talk to you about, which is the RV industry, where we have a great cluster, we have a lot of suppliers, we have a critical mass. I think that those are the things that they look at primarily.
Would it bother you if you were told no because the dollars were going to go to Port of Ventura?
Well,
we're dealing with a finite amount of money.
Yeah, bother me is maybe the wrong way to ask that, because obviously I always want to win. But the question is, do I believe that the money ought to come to us rather than go somewhere else? Where there's a finite amount of money and you have to make the decision, it would depend on the basis, the criteria in which they did that. If they said we're gonna give it to someone else because it's their turn, I might be a little miffed. On the other hand, if we had just gotten three projects funded and they hadn't had anything over there, it'd be hard to complain. What I prefer them to say is that we had a better opportunity to create more jobs, got a chance to help start an industry cluster or help an industry cluster there, or, frankly, because this is a very depressed area that needs to have the help and they do it. In that case, you accept the result and you go on and you keep looking for something else you can do. So I don't know how you can avoid those kinds of.
That's one of the issues this body has to deal with, is the phone calls and the letters of they got it, we didn't. And I don't know the answer, but nonetheless, it's a real issue that we end up dealing with. It's a large state with a small, finite amount of money. And I'm not sure how the department is able to make those decisions. They do. And in some of those, it looks like, in a lot of them, it looks like they're very good decisions. I'm just curious from your perspective, and I appreciate your point.
Yeah, my sense when we talk to them is it's been how many jobs, what kinds of jobs. Obviously, we like to have good family wage jobs with benefits. And then also, is it in the targeted industry clusters that we think have the best growth potential for the future? So let me touch just briefly on the one in... See if Roger Lee's still here. I mean, I don't know if he's sensitive about this or not, but this was a recent situation with Monaco. I figured you would be. This is a situation with Monaco, which is a large motor coach manufacturer. Their headquarters is in Coburg. They actually have their largest distribution is in several plants back in Indiana, which is the largest aggregation of RV manufacturing. But they, a few years ago, bought Beaver Coach in Bend and were continuing to operate that. Unfortunately, recently they decided that they couldn't continue to do that. They did not own their plant in Bend. My understanding is they were not able to buy it. I know they worked with Roger to try to find some other place to locate to, and Bend, like many other parts of our state, are running into a problem of lack of industrial land, and the industrial park that they are working on. Well, it's not going to be ready in time, so they decided they were going to shut down their facility there. And so the question then became not whether they were going to stay in Bend, but were they going to move to Indiana, or were they going to come to Cobourg?
When did they first approach you?
I'm losing track of the time now, but it was about a month, maybe a month and a half ago. It's a very short time frame between that. I think we had about 3 weeks between when they told us and when they were going to make a decision. And we were able to put together, again, on a local basis, and the first one that he called was Bob Warren, the Economic Development Director here, who he'd worked with before, and then I talked to him as well, and we put together a local team, the cities, county, workforce partnership, other folks, got the Economic Development Department involved at the SRS level, SRF level, talked to, had the governor involved. The governor made a phone call. Actually, Senators Wyden and Smith and Congressman DeFazio all made phone calls to try to keep these jobs in Oregon. And at the end of the day, put together a package that was attractive, not only in terms of some training funds and some, and SRF in particular could be used for that, but also commitments on working at the local level to get the hooked up to the sewer, get the I-5 interchange, which is already on the congressional funding package, these things together. And they also stressed the fact that moving to the single sales factor had helped, the fact that they looked good for the reconnect of the federal tax laws. So there were all those components together and ended up keeping 400 of the jobs here in Oregon and allowed that cluster to grow. And this was, again, not an area where it was a question of whether they're going to move to Bend or not. It was having decided to shut down there, we're going to keep the jobs in Oregon. And the Economic Development Department worked very quickly with us together. So those are three examples, I would say, where the partnership that we had, the information sharing that we've always done, all those things were really positive. And to the extent that those kind of partnerships can be encouraged throughout the state, and I know they exist already in a lot of places, that's the way of the future in terms of the recruitment and the expansion and the growth. And that, I think, is the way we look at how we can best leverage those resources that are available and that are finite and build on that for the economy to grow.
I'd like to just follow up on that one comment. The reconnect, you know, has a huge impact on business, and I'm wondering if the representatives in the Senate side are aware of that. I mean, it's one thing for it to go out of the House, but you know, that meant a lot of jobs to Eugene.
And we're certainly trying to help get that message out so people understand that was part of their decision-making process, was the fact that they knew it still wasn't guaranteed, but they were encouraged with the fact that they came out of the House and that made it possible for them to make new investment on a lower after-tax cost, and that therefore that investment could occur here in Oregon instead of in some other state that had those advantages.
That was 400 jobs, and that's
400 family wage jobs in the RV industry, which are good jobs, and good employment. This is a company that already has about 2,400 jobs there at that site, and that and we have others in the RV industry. Our total industry cluster there now, before those new jobs were coming, was 4,800, which for the first time had tied the number of wood products manufacturing jobs in Lane County. That gap had been narrowing, and now with those 400 jobs coming, it's probably going to surpass the wood products industry in Lane County.
Wow. I hope that information makes its way to their senator and to the Senate president and co-chair.
We will make sure that happens.
Really quick question. Would the entity that you represent be put off by economic development creating a couple-day seminar where small communities, counties, and ports could go learn about infrastructure projects?
No, I mean, I think all those things can be worthwhile and can be helpful. The one thing that I would say, though, for small communities, is that quite often, even if you offer those seminars, they're not going to take advantage of them until suddenly they find they need it.
You bet.
And then the question is, if they don't have a seminar schedule, whatever, where's the help going to be? And that's the other thing that I would say about the staffing of the agency and the work of the agency. They need to have the resource there available so they can step in and walk a lot of these communities through things and do the hand-holding, because you just can't expect these small communities to get up to speed. And that part-time recorder you're talking about, you can send to that. Next year's working someplace else, you can train somebody all over again. So I don't think there's ever going to be a substitute for having an adequately staffed and funded agency that can do that help. Because otherwise, places like Eugene, Springfield, Salem, Medford, Bend, Portland, those guys can do it. But there are a whole lot of communities here that are just never going to have the competency. And unless you have an agency that has the time and resources to help them, they're going to miss out on a lot of that.
Well, let's play with that really quick. So, you know, I come from a part of the state where we have a fabulous, fabulous business development officer who covers five counties.
Mm-hmm.
How is she supposed to help a small community with their infrastructure projects when she has everything from the Port of Morrow and the Port of Umatilla to the town of Lexington?
Well, yeah, I'm speaking just for myself here, certainly not speaking for the department, but she can't. And this is one of the problems that we face in looking at how do you get it, because I'm a strong believer in having people out there on the ground who are working the communities. But you look at the level of business activity and you say, gee, to justify a full-time job, you have to cover this whole area. But once you've done that, you've created a dynamic where the person's spending all their time just going from point to point, and they're not able to do it. And so that's the question, is how do you have a staffing system that gives you the people in the communities? And I think one of the ways you do that, and I haven't sat down and figured out the answer, but the concept is you have to have more divisions there, more separations, but then let the people do more things. In Lane County, we can keep someone busy full-time doing economic development, and actually not even doing the community development. That would be somebody else, just doing economic development. We have enough activity there. You don't have that in Eastern Oregon. So someone's got to wear a lot of different hats. But I think you're better off having more people in local communities who wear those different hats. It's sort of like, and Representative Richard understand this in terms of the practice of law. If you're practicing in Portland, you can have a real narrow specialty. If you're practicing in John Day, you better do whatever comes in the door, because that's what you do.
What if we took a finite amount of money and this body said, you know, rather than having people come to a training seminar, we're going to make sure that each of the county has some capacity built into them. Would that be a good idea?
I think it would be a good idea, but I think in order to do that, you're probably going to have that person working maybe even for more than one agency in terms of doing some of the work in that local area. But I think there's a lot that could be said for having more presence by state government in these rural areas, even if it's a person who is more of a generalist and they may be doing three or four different things, but they have the technical resources to help or can tie them into the people who can help. I think if I were looking at one thing that could do the most, not only to get the services out there, but also reconnect and get people to feel like that they're once again represented by their state government, which all those folks don't feel, they think they've been forgotten, I think that would be a way to explore that.
Thank you. Thank you for your thoughts. Okay, let's see here. I'm going to go on our list on who's traveled the furthest away.
And, Mr. Chair, Lynn Beaton, for the record, to try to help you after hearing your criteria, here's what we right now would suggest.
Okay.
If we could have the three guest speakers for the business finance program, Steve Emery, Roger Lee, and Laura Hagenauer, who have collectively traveled the farthest, come first. And then second, have the three folks from the small business programs, Tom Hampson, Esther Puentes, and Marco Alvarado, go second. The rest of the speakers have agreed very kindly to wait until tomorrow to come back to present, but there has been a request on their part that they go first to make sure that they get a chance.
Let's do this. I'm fine with that. I want to make sure that for tomorrow, whoever's creating the agenda with the invited guests, that we don't load it so heavily. We've gone through this now for 2 days, and it's not fair to folks to have to wait this long. And so why don't we take a little smaller increments over the coming days?
Well, Mr. Chair, in light of the questions we're being asked and now understanding how many they are, that makes sense, and we'll do the best that we can.
Thank you.
So it's Roger. Hey, where's the free bubble? I want more water. What's going on?
Well, you better give me the list.
It? Actually, it's not on the list. Everybody knows who's
coming. Everyone knows who's coming up.
Roger's on.
Roger.
Thank you.
please go ahead in the order you choose and make sure you identify yourself for the record.
I'm Steve Emery from Bend, Oregon. I own a water company, Earth 2O, in Culver, Oregon. I also serve as the vice chair, soon to be chair of the governor's small business council, a position that I'd volunteered for after I had inner workings with Oregon Economic Development Council. You have a difficult task with this budget, and I appreciate that, and trying to figure out the highest return on investment that you can to drive the state's economy. And I understand the difficulty in that. As the small business council member, one of the first things we did when we went into it is I heard a day of acronyms, which I didn't understand what they were talking about, nor did any of the other new council members. We had them explain to us. And one of the challenges I see with Oregon economic development, and actually today's hearing as an example, is the difficulty of learning the process and the challenges of being involved in the process. It becomes more daunting to get involved than it does to just go on your business as it on its own. We started working with OEDD as our corporation via the bank, Columbia River Bank. They introduced us. We had loan programs with them. It coincided with what we heard as we traveled around the state with the small businesses. Access to capital, both human resource and financial capital, is a big issue for them, for most small businesses, as well as sales and marketing support, all of which are being covered by the Oregon Economic Development. I stated that we have done a loan program with OEDD, guaranteed program. And Senator Berger earlier talked about what's changing in the state, how you keeping up. That's the business responsibility. It's not the state's responsibility to change businesses. But as a business, we determined to be competitive in the marketplace. In the region, we are the last of the regional water companies of any size and distribution in the marketplace competing against Coke, Pepsi, and Nestle. We needed to do a substantial change on our packaging and become more efficient. And we created equipment that allowed us to do that, first in the industry to eliminate the use of corrugated cardboard, eliminate a lot of waste costs in our production line, and we needed a loan. And because of the historic performance of the company, due to market pressures and some other situations which we had addressed, it was a challenge to do that without some sort of assistance. And the state guaranteed program helped us do that, and today we have 45 employees throughout the state of Oregon. And within the next 12 to 24 months, we look to be adding another 25 to 100% onto that based on contracts coming in. So it was vital. My concerns that I've got based on the bills that have been presented are the following, and it's specific to changing the loan funding program and regionalizing it as opposed to being central area. As it's regionalized, common logic would say that the loan amounts will be reduced, not increased. And I think as you're evaluating the highest return on investment, what type of businesses are going to provide that return on investment as far as increased taxes for the state, improved economics, increased employment for the state? If you're reducing the size of those loan packages, if in fact that does happen, that's an area of concern that we'd like to hear addressed. Cost controls. As you decentralize, it's very difficult to imagine that cost controls stay the same or go down with that. And most importantly is listening to the banking community. Talk with our banker about it. They've had a great experience with Oregon Economic Development. They are the ones that originally referred us to OEDD. And what is the process? What is the speed of the process? I don't think it can get any quicker. On our loan package, the bank had a few stumbling blocks. And they came back and asked for two changes on our loans, which OEDD had responded to within 24 hours on, which I figured there was no chance of that happening, working in a system like this, but they were able to respond on that. And then my final piece is that you have an extraordinarily talented staff that's kind of rare in a public sector where you want to see them not being stolen away in the private sector. And I think you need to recognize the talent of that staff and the offerings that you're presenting right now to business. So, if there's any questions.
Just two things I heard, Steve. One, acronyms and normal kind of human nature. We're going to reduce things to the flow of least resistance. That's going to happen. But the second was regionalization of the loan programs, functionally thinning the soup, not able to apply enough capital to the best projects where you can get the greatest ROI for the state. Is that?
That's correct. Very good.
Let me ask you this question. If the gentleman sitting next to you was your loan officer and had direct lending authority, would you be upset?
I don't know that if there'd be any difference. My concern would be what's the size of the loan that he can authorize.
What if it was the same size?
I'm not sure how you regionalize and do that, but it'd be interesting.
Would you be okay with that?
If it was the same size, I need it larger, honestly.
What our
guarantees were not what we were asking for.
Oh, you're in the...
Bottled water business.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Which program? You used the credit enhancement?
Loan guarantee, yeah.
Credit enhancement program. What if that stayed the same? You're fine with that, I assume. Just leave it here in Salem and be managed here in Salem.
I'm happy with it here.
Terrific.
It worked well for us.
But did you have any experience with the Business Development Fund?
No, we have not.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming.
My name is Laura Hagenauer. I am president of Valley Rolling Corporation. We're located out in Woodburn. Steel roofing and siding manufacturer. We're a new company since January 03, and our company would not be here if it wasn't for the Oregon economy. We actually used working capital funds with an Oregon Business Development Fund loan initially. Without working capital, a brand new business has a very tough struggle making it. We hired on 6 employees initially. We are now up to 12 and add probably about 4 more before the end of the year. We also used one of the enhancement programs when we refinanced our entire business package with Mid Valley Bank, also a local bank, promoting the local idea. One of our primary business goals was to what we called bring the market back to where it belonged in the steel roofing and siding industry. There used to be strong local manufacturing business. Large corporations have came in. They have managed to take funding out. I had worked for a prior company that was national. Money that had gone into the NASDAQ, out of state, out of the country, it's gone. Our goal was to bring that back into Oregon, reestablish the business, take care of our customers the way it used to be, put things back where they belong. With doing that, we also needed to hire more employees. We also used the Marion County Lottery Funding Program. That is how we brought in 5 of the employees that we have. We also used the Jobs Plus program with the unemployment office, and we've taken a couple of people off of the unemployment rolls. We have used several local businesses that needed additional business due to, you know, competitive issues that were going on that we've helped, you know, in their businesses by bringing all those dollars back into Oregon. Just short and sweet on us. We love the program. Dave Dahlin has been excellent. We have, been interviewed. Yeah, it's a customer. It's probably money. It's probably steel coil. Our small business out in Woodburn, we bring in steel coil on ships. We bring it into the docks in Seattle. We bring it into Vancouver, Washington, and then also down in California. So, I mean, we're pulling shipping throughout Oregon, Washington, into California. We have product in Alaska. It's all being produced locally here, and we intend to keep growing and hiring locals.
How many customers do you have?
We have about 150 right now.
How long did it take you to get 150 customers?
We had 75 in the first 6 months. We actually were, the easiest way to explain it, I myself had 16 and a half years in the business when we started. My partner and brother had 9. When we hired the first 6, which included my brother and myself, there was 100 years of experience in the first year.
Do you know how many loan officers are in the department?
No.
4. What would you say if you knew that they made and closed 15 business development fund loans in an 18-month period of time? As a taxpayer, what would you say?
I would first ask
the
question.
I'm glad they closed one of them.
I'd want to know, you know, as a taxpayer, is my money helping something in the area? Were these loans, you know, good loans?
You can see, I mean, you've obviously been prepped on one of the conversations here.
Actually not. I was listening on the very last few. I didn't come in until, close to an hour ago now.
One of the issues we're dealing with is trying to figure out, with the big state and 4 very talented loan officers, what's the best way to make sure all parts of the state have access to capital.
And one of the things that we're looking at is just how are the loans being made and disseminated. And one of the things that we're trying to struggle with is 15 loans were closed in about an 18-month period of time. And we're trying to figure out, is there a better way to get more than 15 loans? And an entrepreneur with 150, 160 customers probably can understand it's important to continue to keep things moving, to keep growing. And so just...
And I feel with the Oregon Economic, Dave Velling, the response times, the items that we have covered, and how well the relationships work with the local banks has been, oh, it's excellent.
They're good folks.
We also use the SBA program.
Yeah.
Hands down, we wanted to get out of the SBA program. It was very cumbersome.
Yeah.
You know, sold items that weren't actually as easily accessible as what we were told, so... In comparison, the Oregon Economic Funding that we were able to receive that has bolstered our business is, you know, it's astronomical, and it was so much more readily available, easier to get to.
Terrific. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
And thank you very much, because this funding program does mean a lot, and that is why I'm here.
It's a good it's a good tool.
It is.
It's a very good tool.
Excellent.
Much continued success.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Keep my comments very brief. I'd just also like to speak to the finance programs of the state. It's something that I'm very passionate about. It's one of the programs that's remained consistent over the last two decades, and it's one that we know we can count on when we're talking to businesses. There's not a week that goes by that we don't talk to businesses about one of the four programs the state offers. Of the 38 projects that were approved by the department over the last two biennia in the Central Oregon region, that's Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson County, we think they've made a big economic impact. That's the over $13 million approved. I'd also like to speak to the regionalization idea for these programs. I think if you want some good example of how that works, just look at the Regional Strategies Program and look at the success administered at the state level with experienced professionals reviewing projects, and then look at the success after that program was regionalized. And I think you'll find that success was much better at the state level, with some real professional review level at that versus when it went out to the different communities. I got to be a part of that out in Eastern Oregon. I can tell you what happened with the resources. They got divided up into small projects. They got divided up on a political basis, not necessarily on a merit basis for those projects in many cases. And I think it took many years for that to get straightened out again.
We painted a lot of murals.
Yes. Did a lot of bathrooms, did some flower pots.
Who's your SBA lender? SBA 50.
We have many of the banks have special lending groups just for SBA. We also have COIC, which does that.
How do they do?
Sorry.
How does your EDA organization do? COIC.
They do just fine.
Are they decent lenders?
They are decent lenders.
Pretty responsive.
Mm-hmm.
How would you rate them?
In relation to what?
A to F.
I would say the middle of the road between some of the aggressive bankers and some of the lesser aggressive bankers.
You think, would it upset you if you had to go visit with them to package a business development fund loan?
I prefer to work with the state.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, Roger, when did we trend into regional strategies? When did we start that?
It was a program of the Goldschmidt administration and...
87?
That's right. It's passed by the legislature in 85.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wondered.
Roger, what do you think about statewide, 18 entrepreneurial development loan funds were closed in an 18-month period of time?
It's probably a good indication of the type of program it is and the risk of the loans and opportunity of the businesses. EDLF funds, which is, I'll use one of those acronyms, it's really directed towards very early stage companies just starting out. So,
do you think 18 represents a good outreach to the state?
I think 18 probably represents the situation of the state and national economy, as well as the limits of the program. This program is not designed for every business.
Okay. What do you think about under the Business Development Fund? You're aware of that. 15 loans closed statewide over 18 months.
Similarly, the approved Business Development Loan Fund also has very many restrictions. It's not a program that funds business in general. It has to be partnership with the bank. It's a 40% loan only.
Do you think there's good outreach?
I think there's great outreach. I think we talk, that's what I talk to company about. Talk to companies about every week is OBDF primarily.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Smith, yeah. I just might. One of the items that, as I'm hearing you asking these questions, with like Dave Dahleen, he has learned our business.
Right.
He sat down with us initially. When it came to what programs were out there, we said, here, this is what we show, what we're looking for. I think part of the reason, you know, you're looking at 15 loans closed, 18 closed, you know, we weren't sold something we didn't need.
Right.
It was very direct. You know what you're going for, and you're there.
It's pretty powerful being able to work with someone hands-on, isn't it?
Oh, it's excellent.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for coming a long way, guys.
Thank you.
Let's see. Who wants to come up next? Who do we have next? I'll let you take the lead on this one.
Mr. Chair, the next final three speakers that we have for you today are Tom Hampson, Esther Puentes, and Marco Alvarado, talking about the small business.
Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I'm on first.
It's good seeing you again.
Good seeing you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Tom Hampson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Native American Business and Entrepreneurial Network. ONABEN, I'm one of those difficult acronyms, and now a branded name for us, was founded in 1991 by Oregon tribes that felt that small business development was a critical and essential element to their economic diversification. It was in their interest and their desire to create a private sector within Indian country, and they chose small business as one of their key strategies. We support, very much like the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network, a network of small business development centers on Indian reservations, and we, as our own office in Portland metro area, also serve as a small business development center for Native Americans within the I-5 corridor. Over the last 10 years, ONABEN and its network has served approximately over 10,000 individuals, depending upon how you count the services provided, through classes and workshops and one-on-one technical assistance. Out of that, over 300 businesses have been started and continue to be assisted by our organization. The annual report I've provided to you, and I'd be happy to discuss any questions and concerns you have about performance and about our operations, but fundamentally I'm here to tell you a story. And my reputation as a storyteller is often at odds with my reputation as a timekeeper. And so I'll do a good colleague in Pendleton, a very talkative colleague in Pendleton, I would always tell her that if she had anything important to say, start at the end and work backwards. And that's what I'll try to do today. Takeaway number one, the Oregon Community and Economic Development Department has been an extremely critical part of our funding mix through their programs that they've supported us since 1996. We are one of those, quote, targeted services providers. This money represents, on average, about 25% of our funding base, but as a match, it has helped for every $1 we have received in state dollars, depending upon the year, between $3 to $4 to $5 of private sector, foundation, and federal dollars. Although, as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, the federal dollars have been in diminishing supply lately. Takeaway number two, even though the demand for our services is increasing and we have demands from other tribes within Oregon to create small business development centers and other people needing services, given the current budget challenges that this committee and our state now faces, I think it would be irresponsible to ask for additional dollars to support this program. I can, though, have no qualms about supporting a level of funding level that's the same as it has been in the past, as consistent with the governor's budget. Takeaway number three, the small business service providers around the state need to reflect and respond to the constituencies that they serve. At the same time, we must work together to maximize services to all small business owners of Oregon. We are many people, but we are one state. The department needs to support and reflect that diversity, and I think it has done so with its approaches and its perspectives. At the same time, they must be clever and they must be strategic in how they use precious state resources, given that it takes me to takeaway number four, which is we are here to be part of that process. There's been much discussion of late on proposals to restructure the department, and I've been asked by Sam Brooks to read a letter into the record, which I will do so with your permission, but not until I've finished my story. As Sam indicates in his letter, we stand ready as the service providers to assist the department and the legislature in any way that is appropriate to make the department function better. I've been an observer and a participant with the department since I shared an office in LeGrand with John Group, who was the first regional representative from Eastern Oregon in 1973. John was an old shoe salesman. Over these many administrations, I've seen many efforts to restructure the department. All have been well-intended, and I'm sure the jury is still out on which, if any, resulted in the changes that the reformers intended. But over these years, I've learned one principle of government reform that is time-proven and unfailing. If you hire good people to do the agency's work, good things will be done by the agency. The best example I can give you is Bev Kupperman, who as a frontline representative of the agency makes that agency a responsive and customer-friendly organization. Bev gets what we do and helps us do it. And kudos to Ron Fox for allowing her the space to do her job as well as she does. The department is recognized in Oregon Indian Country as one of the strongest and most creative proponents of the governor's executive order on government-to-government relations with the tribes. And that is by no accident. It is not because all other agencies have the same mandate, but Economic Development Department has done so because people like John Jaquil, when he was with the firm, Mike Burton and Tom Brown now, have decided that it was important and made it a priority. And I can tell you that the tribes respect and appreciate that effort. So in other words, people more than structure make the difference. Still, the idea of creating a separate division devoted solely to small business has an undeniable appeal. If it is a true reflection of the priorities of the agency and not just another silo, as has been mentioned. And what do I mean by silo? That's where the story comes in. I was the founding director of the Tribal Development Office for the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation in that same year of 1973. I left to operate my own business in a small farm outside of Pendleton. In 1988, I utilized that experience and became one of the first founding members of the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network in 1988. Now, my SBDC in Pendleton for Blue Mountain Community College had lots of Indian clients to the extent that there was an interest in entrepreneurship on the reservation. So when Omabin was suggested as a viable entity in the early 1990s, I thought it was pretty much a duplication of effort. I thought it was something that the SBDC certainly could do and must be doing. I was wrong. When I was asked to assume the reins of Omabin, I discovered that the SBDCs didn't have many Indian clients, and the reason that I did was that the people knew me, and that those boundaries to cross were not extensive because of who I was. The SBDCs still don't have a lot of Indian clients because, one, they don't have the resources to cover the territory, and two, these culture barriers are real in our communities, just as the barrier between small business owners and a community college are real. In fact, our mission statement as an organization included a reference to what the SBDCs were not doing. One of my first tasks in directing the organization was to take that part of the mission statement out, and I did that for two reasons. One, the SBDCs are a critical, important resource for us and as we do our work. And two, you can't define your purpose in terms of what somebody else is not doing. And I think that's a tenet that many political parties could probably use well. We've committed and proven our abilities to collaborate and get out of the silos by co-sponsoring all of our programs and services within SBDC service areas where they are, whether it's in Coos Bay, in Ashland, or wherever. It's a bridge-building device, and what we've discovered is that it not only breaks down the barriers between the two organizations and the agencies, but, of course, it maximizes the resource for the client, and that's what we're here for. Now, there's a lot of talk in the industry, whether you call it the micro-enterprise industry or the small business industry, about the whole notion of silos, about programs being separate and distinct and not collaborating. And there are good reasons for the whole idea of
characterize them as silos because there's a history of lack of duplication of effort and lack of coordination, if not outright competition. But the solutions that have always been proposed in the new forms are called system integration and getting us out of the silos to work together. And I know this is part of the well-intended reasoning behind some of the reorganization efforts, and I applaud it. But here's what I've learned with the fun that I've had in agriculture. If you've got soft white wheat or barley or maybe a little canola, you have to keep them in separate silos. If you have two silos of wheat, maybe it makes economic sense to combine them. But I'll have to say that when the stuff gets to the bakery, it gets all mixed together to make bread and a whole lot of other very interesting products. And that's what we are doing. Onabin, OWAMI, the SBDCs, OMIN, all of those acronyms, the minority chambers of commerce, we're all making bread. For us, having our own cultural identity, our own brand, if you will, is critical to getting the people to come into the office. Really, once they are there, it's all about...
Let me ask you a quick question.
You bet.
How many of the tribal members are members of regional and rural investment boards?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would have no idea. I know that just out of personal knowledge that Dave Tovey has participated in that process substantially when he was in Pendleton and now he's in Coos Bay, and I would suggest that there's at least one tribal representative on each one of those kinds of boards, but with the regional investment boards particularly, I couldn't say.
Do you think it would be important for the tribes to be represented on the regional and rural investment?
Oh, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's absolutely critical. And I think I get around a lot in Indian country, and I observe state-tribal relations for the last 30 years. And Oregon is one by far and away heads above all other states in terms of its relationship with the tribes and the way that they have tried to integrate the economic development departments and policymakers as well as elected officials into those systems. And the Economic Development Department has been a leader in insisting that that be the case.
Good.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So back to the bread analogy. So once, but we use cultural affiliation just as any other organization would to get people in the door. But once we're in the door, it's our job to help people learn about the many resources that are available and help them utilize that so that they're adding a little bit of this, a pinch of that, and out of it comes a whole array of interesting and prosperous goods and services. I think this perspective can be applied to your challenge as well in making the agency, this or any other, more effective. It all comes down to know when to silo and when not to. Know how to make priorities and walk the talk, and I appreciate the committee's efforts in prioritization processes. And of course, finally, the secret to ensuring that all will be that it will all get done is to find good people to do it. We stand ready to assist you in any way that we can, and we thank you for your time and attention. And I know that you have a text of Sam Burke's letter. I know for purposes of time, I would offer to read it or to acknowledge that it's in the record. Your pleasure, Mr. Chairman.
Do you feel like Native American entrepreneurs know about all the programs and services that are available to them?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one of the advantages that we have and the way that Onabin became a branded entity, even though it's an acronym, has something to do with the cultural attributes of the communities that we serve, namely things like the Moccasin Telegraph and the ways that in business, small business, word of mouth is the best advertising. And we find name recognition for Onabin as an organization to be very high, even though it was at one time a very clumsy acronym. And we changed the utilization of the word to say, in fact, we changed our brand into Onabin, a Native American Business Network. I often get asked what Onabin stands for, and I say it's an Indian word for the Oregon Native American Business and Entrepreneurial Network.
You may not know this. I actually, in my past years, a long time ago, actually had an evening job working with Onabin. They had a situation where an instructor at the last minute wasn't able to teach a class,
And so they had me fill in for five or six in Pendleton. Winnaubyn's a terrific organization.
Mr. Chairman, I'm aware of that. I actually have the class evaluation right here.
You did a very good job. You put them on the table right now.
You did.
Right unseen.
You got excellent marks.
Thank you. Let me ask you this question. One of the things this committee has made a high priority is reaching out to women, minorities, and emerging small business, and making sure that every Oregonian knows what is available to every Oregonian, and making sure that every Oregonian has an opportunity to start a small business or to expand their small business. Right now, we have multiple places around the state, in state agencies, that focus on women, minority, and emerging small businesses. Do you think that's the best way to reach out to minorities, or do you think it'd be better to have a place with a focused effort, kind of a one-stop shop? I'm not sure where that term comes from, but I've heard it before, a one-stop shop where business owners who are minority or women or emerging could turn to find out, how do I register to do business with the state of Oregon? How do I register to do business with the city of Portland? Who's advocating for me? How do I get involved on a local board? Where do people turn to right now?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a critical question, and I like the former Labor Commissioner's answer in terms of it. It is a situational. The answer is situational. The whole notion of one stop is one of those great American bureaucratic myths that in the sense of a platonic ideal, it's something that we all aspire to, we would all love to have it, and yet there are a lot of real practical reasons why it is so difficult to achieve. We must constantly strive to work towards that ideal, and there are good strategies and better strategies and not so good strategies, and each one of them are dependent upon a situation. I have to leave. I have to be sure that I leave early enough to be in Grand Ronde and at 5:30 because I'm teaching a class. Our Starting a Successful Business class at Grand Ronde. And one of my challenges is when those questions come up, where do I go if I want to be certified? Are there benefits to being certified? Where do I go in this particular town or this particular county to get a business license? I want to be able for sure to point them in one place. The reality is that even the most expert of people who understand the system are going to have to encourage the person to do their own research as well. And so it's a continual balance.
You work with a lot of Native American entrepreneurs. Is their first thought on doing business with the state of Oregon to call the Department of Consumer and Business Services, or is it to call the Economic and Community Development Department, or the Department of Transportation, or the Governor's Office?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think they think about any of those issues.
Exactly. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Smith and other committee members. I'm Esther Puentes, President of Interface Network, and I'd like to introduce also one of our business startups that we have been working with, and I'd like for him to just introduce himself right now.
Buenas tardes, señor chairman, miembros del comité. Espero que no esté fuera de lugar hablando español.
It's Michael Alvarado, and he said good afternoon, and that he hopes that you feel comfortable in having him speak Spanish. Okay.
I do. I don't okay. understand Spanish,
okay.
but
so I'll do just
we'll smile to each other.
Okay. Interface Network is new to the OECDD programs, having implemented the program for a year and a half, but we're not new to the work in working with small business development and working with diverse populations. And although Interface Network has been in practice since 1986, I'm going to focus on the Latino population, but once again, I'd like you to know that Interface is an organization that works in the area of diversity. So we're talking about other cultural and language groups, and then also other aspects of diversity.
Statewide?
Yes. National and international.
Perfect.
Okay? We've done a lot of international work, and the majority of our diversity work is national. But what I'm going to do is right now focus on our small business development program targeting the Latino population. I'm going to begin by just giving some quick statistics. The Latino population is the largest minority sector in the state of Oregon, significantly contributing to the economy of Oregon. Over the past 10 years, the Oregon Latino community has increased by 100% to 320,000. The Latino workforce in Oregon has increased by 170%, while the overall state workforce increased by 16%. The Latino buying power in Oregon has reached $4.3 billion annually. By 2008, and we're talking about 3 years, Oregon Latino buying power will double to $8.4 billion. Latino buying power will increase by 100%, while the overall Oregon buying power will increase by 20%. Latinos are more and more becoming an increased tax base of revenue for the state of Oregon. The Latino community is a dynamic economic force in our state. Due to these statistics, along with others, Interface Network has had an opportunity to work with Fortune 500 corporations, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Merck International, Frito-Lay, Verizon, AT&T, and many others, and implementing training and technical assistance programs in the area of diversity as a business imperative. What motivates these companies? The bottom line. It is good business. And why do I bring this training that Interface does with corporations? It's because, once again, corporations have probably been in the forefront of working in the area of diversity or bilingual, bicultural. There's many terms that is utilized in reaching out to diverse populations and servicing them. It is imperative to continue programs that serve specific segments, such as the OECDD programs that serve linguistically and culturally diverse community members, including the Latino community. Why? Once again, because of the bottom line. It is good business. As a consequence of the growth of the Latino market, Latino businesses in Oregon have increased by 100%. Since 1992, Latino-owned businesses posted sales that increased at twice the rate of all businesses. And there is not my colleague Marina Areola, who is in the audience here, does a lot of research with demographics, and it's real difficult to find statistics and information on Latino businesses in the state of Oregon. I think the most that we have been able to access has been through the Oregon Employment Department, through Mary Lewis and her staff. According to a 1997 figure, there are over 6,000 Latino businesses operating in the state of Oregon, and we're talking about quite a few years, so I'm sure that it is quite large, because what my colleagues and I have experienced is that within especially the last 5 years, we noticed that there's more and more Latino businesses being started. These businesses employ an average of 5 to 10 employees. Current and future Latino businesses are the future economic growth engine of Oregon. These businesses are predicted to create numerous jobs in Oregon over the next 20 years. But with this wonderful economic thrust or force, there are some challenges. And I'd like to just briefly state some of the specific needs that the Latino community, business community, has in looking at enhancing and growing their businesses or in having the Latino community members start their businesses. My colleague and I conducted a survey. It's been now two and a half years for the department Department of Labor, and we conducted focus groups, we conducted one-on-one interviews through surveys of Latino community members and Latino business owners. And again and again and again, what we found is, whether it was in Portland and Medford and Bend and in Salem, lack of access to information. Okay? Whether we were targeting small business development, but what we found is that they deviated to talking about health care, they started talking about housing, etc. But overall is not being able to access information readily like the other community members. Okay? So let me continue with some of the specific needs. research documents that it takes 7 to 10 years to acquire a second language to use it as a native speaker. For example, to use it as a vehicle of instruction to learn abstract concepts. Most of the target Latino clients, the business owners and startups, are non or limited English proficient. For this population, outreach, training, technical assistance, and information dissemination is more effective if conducted in their first language. And I'd like to also interject that while we do teach our seminars, our one-on-one consultations, and our computer classes for business purposes in Spanish, they also have a choice, though, whether it can be taught in English and Spanish. But a lot of these business owners and community members that are looking at startups are accessing English as a second language courses.
Well, let me ask you this question. Do you think a Latino entrepreneur would have a difficult time determining today how to do business with the state of Oregon?
A very difficult time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to another point. Culture is a key element in understanding what is behind the variety of client responses and reactions. Culture determines how we behave and interact with others. It is more than a language.
Mm-hmm.
It is the being of a person, the self. It is the way we do things. It is how we view the world, how we communicate, how we learn, how we relate to time, eye contact, and how we solve conflict. These are just some examples. Simply translating the same business development material one uses with mainstream sector into Spanish or another diverse language is not effective. Okay? Interface's business development program uses linguistically and culturally appropriate practices. 80% of the Latinos in the state of Oregon are of the Mexican origin. Okay? And I know I don't have a lot of time, and this would take like a 101 class, okay, in cultural diversity. But having 80% of the Latinos here in Oregon come from Mexico, there's a whole history there of people that are leaving Mexico and come to the United States is to work. Okay, they're not leaving their countries because they want to. It's because they're here to work, and there's work for them to do, so therefore it's a match. But what that means is that the people coming over, in many cases, are of the literacy level or the educational background is not a high level. Okay, otherwise they would stay in their country and probably have businesses there, etc. Okay, so literacy is a key to the success of our training and technical assistance programs. It is a critical factor in the development of training materials and in the selection of education methodology. The targeted provider programs, such as Interface, develop and implement training curriculum, tapping the different learning preferences, styles, and skills of the target population. For example, Interface uses language that is skill level appropriate and relevant to the needs of the diverse small business owners. Quality small business development curriculum can be developed without, I hate to use this word, but it's lack of a better term, dumbing it down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because they need to know the exact information as mainstream business owners, but they need to receive it maybe in a different way.
Let me ask you this question. How difficult would it be for a Latino entrepreneur who wants to hire their first employee to figure out the process and to do it legally? Under today's current structure of working with the many different departments within the state?
Okay, I know that if they have gone through our training, they could probably do it.
What if they have?
If they haven't, they probably have a difficult time. And it's real critical to understand that it's learning about the process,
right.
Okay? But then also really talking about the two cultural systems. Okay, because if you're coming from Nicaragua, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Mexico, etc., where these regulations or policies that aren't in place, their assumption that they do business the same way.
Right.
Okay.
One of the communications this committee has had over the last couple months is finding a way to streamline the process for hiring the first employee. So that way, an entrepreneur, no matter who you are,
yes. Uh-huh.
has one place to come to
to deal with the Department of Revenue, to deal with Consumer and Business Services for worker comp issues, to deal with the Bureau of Labor, to deal with the Secretary of State, and have it all in one spot. So that way the entrepreneur is able to make perhaps one phone call or one email.
As opposed to having to go
to multiple places. If that was done, and it was done also in Spanish, would that help an entrepreneur?
Okay, in Spanish and in a very inclusive and receptive way. Okay.
Do you think Latino business owners who haven't hired their first employee, this may be a barrier that could be removed by doing that? That would help them get their first employee? Thank you.
Okay. All outreach, educational, technical assistance, and information dissemination activities and events, and this is where I go by when I state, Chair Smith, that in a respective and inclusive way, is that if they should be guided by the principle that each individual is respected and his and her contribution is valued.
Right.
Valuing of each individual is critical to the learning process and in developing opportunities for inclusion, active participation, and in building partnerships. Okay? Interface uses grassroots strategies and outreach into the Latino community. We go where the community members go. We interact with the community Latino leaders. We are part of the Latino network. And it's important to understand that, yes, all our staff are Hispanic or Latino origin, but it's more than that. We're skilled, we're knowledgeable. Many of us have masters in what's termed bicultural, bilingual, or multicultural strategies. Okay, so sometimes people look at it and say, oh, well, they just have to learn English. I wish that it was that simple, but it's not that simple. Okay. This last point is so critical that we have Latino business.
I want to ask a question.
Okay.
Someone coming from Honduras, entrepreneur, wanting to do business with the state of Oregon, and they receive a loan application from the state of Oregon. Is that going to be a new experience for them, completing a loan application, unless they've gone through your course?
Very, very much so. But more than that is, once again, because they're coming from countries where things operate differently, okay? One of the major areas, like, for example, we've been working with these programs for a year and a half. Okay, what we're teaching about the loan process is business development, development of a business plan, is the paper track, it's the financial management. Okay, they have to have all these in place, and then they're going to be able to pursue small business loans.
Do you think it makes sense to have a business plan, make sure they understand
the process,
and then they apply for a loan?
And also so that when they do apply for a loan, they're going to be successful. Because if they were, let's say an entrepreneur is to come and go immediately for a loan, they will not have their business papers in order.
Thank you.
So that's a learning process there.
Thank you.
Okay. This last point is so critical that we have Latino business owners calling Interface from throughout the state requesting services, coming to Salem or meeting us halfway from Eugene, Roseburg, Madras, and other parts of the state. Okay. The Latino business community and the community at large pay taxes. Approximately 95%, and we do ask this question because we also encourage them to contact the SBDCs. Okay, we do with any one of our businesses. We have worked with under this program had not previously received business development services. Equal access is very critical, obviously, to all members of the committee members in Oregon. The Latino community should be able to benefit from programs that their taxes support. Okay. And with this, I'd like to end that I came back, I think I attended, it was about 2 weeks ago, I attended a national conference, and the title of the conference was Innovations in Hispanic Outreach and Marketing, okay? And it was a statewide national conference, and there were representatives from corporations and public sector, state agencies also, and they were there to get information, to learn how to outreach and partner with the Latino community, both as business but also as consumers. and a lot of dialogue went on, and it wasn't just California and Texas and New Mexico and Arizona. You know, those states that you that you think of when you think of the Hispanic or Latino population. But you had states represented there from representatives from states such as Georgia, North Carolina, Arkansas, Tennessee, states that just recently have been impacted by this population. And the dynamic exchange of information was just phenomenal. And I would like to see that Oregon, as a state, embraces this community, you know, as an because they are proven to be an economic force.
Well, I definitely appreciate the department working with Interface to make this happen, because we definitely need to get ahead of the curve, not be behind the curve. And this is a good first step. I speak for myself as the chair of this committee, not for the committee, when I tell you that I think every Oregonian has a right to do business in the state of Oregon, and we need to be doing all we can to reach out to every Oregonian to let them know what services we can provide. It's fair, and it's the right thing to do. So I truly appreciate all three of you coming today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have one more person. Oh.
Well, I think he just wants to make a statement.
Oh, okay. I apologize. Okay. I apologize, sir.
Señora Smith, Chairman, and los miembros del comité, quiero comenzar diciendo...
Chair Smith and the committee members, I'd like to begin with...
Que me gustó mucho la analogía de no tires el pescado, pero enséñalo a pescar.
That he really liked the analogy or the statement that you said about... don't give them fish, but teach them how to fish.
Thank you.
That you had made earlier today.
Por la razón de que yo soy un dueño de un pequeño negocio.
Because he is a small business Latino small business owner.
Este negocio va a cumplir 2 años en el primero de mayo.
It's going to complete 2 years in May.
Me ha sido un poco difícil el comienzo.
It was very difficult for him to begin.
Estoy trabajando para una empresa de comunicaciones y de ahí saco el dinero para poder ayudar a mi negocio.
He works, and the money that he earns from that he puts into his small business.
Y en esta tarde estoy aquí como un testimonio para decir el beneficio que he recibido de la Interface Network.
And he's here today to talk about how some of the training and technical one-on-one consultations that he received from Interface have assisted.
La primera vez que fui a un seminario fue en septiembre 8 del 2003.
The first seminar that he attended was in September of 2003.
Y en ese día comenzó en mí una ansiedad por crear mi negocio.
And after that meeting, or that day started, it became very emotional and motivated about beginning his business.
Porque estuvieron hablando acerca de los diferentes programas que ellos proveen para nosotros.
Because of the services that were described that would be able to assist him, like the one-on-one consultations and the computer classes for business purposes.
Como miembro de la comunidad hispana, tengo muchas amistades que tienen restaurantes, panaderías.
As a member of the Latino community, business community, he has a lot of friends that own restaurants and bakeries.
Y algunos de ellos también han asistido a los programas de ayuda.
And many of them also have attended these services.
Número uno, porque son clases netamente en español.
Number one is because they are taught in Spanish.
Y la cultura se identifica.
And the culture is acknowledged and identified.
Y el trabajo del nivel educacional es muy bueno para nosotros.
And the level of the information that they receive is quality.
Yo solamente fui 6 años a la escuela.
He himself has 6 years of education from Mexico.
Pero aquí he podido atender a clases de computación que Interface Work nos está dando.
But here he was able to attend computer classes for business purposes that we had offered.
También he podido escuchar un desarrollo de plan de negocios.
And also has learned about business plan development.
También he podido tener servicio al cliente.
A customer service.
Y como mi negocio es una librería.
And his business is a bookstore.
Yo quiero participar en la economía del estado de Oregon.
He wants to participate in Oregon's economy.
Y necesito agarrar la educación.
And he's excited about and or needs to receive education training.
Y no solamente educación, pero la información que se necesita para poder ser un buen negociante.
And not only the skills, but the information needed to be an effective business owner.
Y en esta tarde quiero dejar claro.
And this afternoon he wants to leave with, or he wants to make clear.
Que me siento muy a gusto en el estado de Oregon.
That he very much likes being here in Oregon.
Es uno de los más hermosos lugares que he conocido.
It's the most beautiful place that he has experienced.
Y quiero quedarme para siempre, si se puede.
And he would like to stay here.
Y también quiero dar gracias a Esther Puentes por la programa que tiene de Interface Network.
And he'd like to thank Interface Network.
Y podamos también seguir teniendo programas para los hispanos que podamos aprender más inglés.
And he's excited about the programs for the Latinos, Hispanics, and also focusing on English as a second language, to learn English.
Y conocer acerca de la tecnología.
And to learn the technology.
Y aprovechar los medios tecnológicos.
And to implement the methodologies and strategies.
Para poder crecer como hombre de negocios.
To be able to enhance and grow his business.
Nosotros como hispanos.
We as Hispanics.
Tenemos una reputación de ser hombres de negocios.
Have a reputation of being business owners.
Pero necesitamos la herramienta.
But we need the assistance.
Y la educación.
And the education.
Con esto quiero decirles muchas gracias.
He wants to say thank you.
Por tenerme y por su atención.
For giving him some time to speak.
Please tell him thank you, gracias. And we wish him many profitable years in Oregon.
Gracias.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Would you please send me information about your program?
Okay. I will do that.
And I'd like to visit with you.
Oh, okay.
At some point, if you have a time to make an appointment with me.
Okay, we'd like to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cole. Commissioner Cole. Commission Chair Cole. There'll always be a commissioner to be.
All right. And this is Bill Pashing. Bill is the president of the Oregon Economic Development Association.
Bill, how are you?
Great.
You want to go first? You want me to go first?
No, I'm here to give moral support. So
oh, all right.
Okay. I have written testimony that I'll provide, and that will be all I'll do today.
Terrific. Terrific. Okay.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Westland, thank you for the invitation to be here, and thank you for sticking with us the whole way.
For you hanging.
Oh, absolutely. Just a quick background on myself. I got involved in economic development in 1987, as Greg knows. I can't call you Senator Smith, or Representative Smith. I know I need to here. We go way back. I hope Senator Westland's not leaving because I'm about to pay you a big compliment.
No, I have audio capability.
All right, good.
please let him leave.
A very sincere one, too. But my background in economic development really is in four different chairs, so I've had a chance to see it from all sides, as a local economic developer, as a regional development officer for the state, as a county commission chairman trying to make things happen in my county, and now as an economic development consultant, and also serving as staff as the executive director of the Oregon Economic Development Association. I just wanted to make a kind of a quick observation about the two gentlemen that remain here. I think this is the 10th legislative session that I've paid attention to. I don't think that a legislative session has gone by where there wasn't very specific scrutiny and review of the Oregon Economic Development Department or the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. And I'll speak to that here a little bit later. But I think it's a good thing. And Representative Smith, I think that you probably sit in that chair with more background on economic development than any person that has sat in that chair for a long, long time. I go back to probably Representative and then Senator Wayne Fawbush, I think, who had a lot of knowledge about economic development. And I think that's a good thing. Way off the point, Senator Westland, but it's been about 5 years since we've been in the same room together, but since then I've followed you in the press, I followed your illness, I'm very pleased and thankful to God that you are well now, and I just wanted to thank you for your leadership on revenue issues of the state and the courage that it takes to do that.
We're talking tax reform, folks.
Yep, we are. We are, and
thank you.
I appreciate you for that. It was about 20 years ago that I was across the street at Willamette University at the graduate program, and some speaker came in, and he said, "If it ain't broke," and he paused, and I thought I knew what he was going to say, and then he said, "Break it and make it better." And it really, I guess it made an impact on me, because that is the mindset I tend to bring to things. And Representative Smith, I think that's what you're bringing here. I really do not believe that it is broke right now. I really do believe that what we have in this agency after what I believe is close to 30 years of operation and legislative sessions is accumulation of a lot of problems solved that have left us with a lot of programs that a lot of states don't have right now. We have business finance programs that other states don't have. We have a governor with the capacity to close deals that other states don't have. Some other states do, but you have to go a few miles before you find one there. And I really hope that the result of this legislative session is to empower our communities and our leaders and our governors to do what we need to do to continue to make things happen. And I know after a 45-minute conversation in my driveway with you, Representative Smith, I was playing tennis with Christy, I believe, thinking how good I was doing being a good dad and a good executive director for AWEDA at the same time, that I know that we had enough chance to connect that I believe your heart is in making the system work better. And I think by asking some tough questions, I think we get there. I think by ignoring the questions, we don't get there. And so I think that it's very good to take a look at this and kind of take a look at breaking it and then figuring out whether or not we would put it back together the same way. If it were up to me, it would look pretty darn close to what it is today if we broke it and put it back together. And specifically, I just reflect back on the business finance programs. I've been around since 1987 in a number of capacities, and I've done a number of deals. And I cannot think of one deal that the right decision wasn't made on in terms of the staff of the Economic Development Department, whether it's Oregon Business Development Fund or Credit Enhancement Fund, Capital Access Program. And I really haven't been involved with that many. Being in a rural community, there are not a lot of real good deals that fit those programs. I don't have expertise to take a look at the portfolio and know whether there's enough action on that. I actually think you have greater expertise than I on that. But my personal experience is that when the deal needed to be made, the professionals at the Economic Development Department got it done. And when the man that sits in this chair and speaks, I speak of Roger Lee, who I respect as much as anybody in this business, he is technically very competent and he's very aggressive. And he's in a part of our state that's growing amazingly fast. And when he gives that type of statement that these programs are working, that resonates with me. His other comment and the analogy to regional strategies, I would reinforce. Regional strategies started out as a program in 1987. Governor Goldschmidt had the vision, and it was implemented by the legislature. And it was centralized, and it created a dynamic where you had to compete to get the money. Now, I'm in the minority here, but I'm with Roger on this. The change in 1993 caused that program to be formalized and decentralized, and all of a sudden you didn't have to think and you didn't have to compete to get the money. You had to breathe. And the effect of that has been, you know, it sounds good to have local decision-making, but what happens is that the local pressure, you know, I was county commissioner, I know about local pressure, to do what is easy at the moment, I think is a dangerous thing for our business finance programs. I really do. I think we do have those programs. They exist now. Our economic development districts and others administrate those programs. I think it's healthy for our state to maintain centralized control of the programs that we've got. I would encourage them to continue to be capitalized. If it is that they are not generating the loans at the speed that we think they ought to be, and that may be the case. I turned around and asked my good friend Dave Belline, he feels very comfortable that they're making loans that they ought to be making. But I think, you know, it's not a bad idea to scrutinize that. Finally, I would speak to the broader issue of business recruitment and business development. And again, we've got good programs, especially the Strategic Reserve Fund. I would really encourage the governor's recommendation on that budget to be met or maybe exceeded there. We need those dollars to close deals. You've heard already how important those have been. A program that I haven't heard about, and I'm not sure it's on the table, it's not even with this agency, but the credit or the Community Incentive Fund, and I know you're familiar with it, Representative Smith, is another good centralized program, not for job creation as much, but for community development. And I would like to see that program continue to be supported. My vice chair, Steve Vincent, had made a comment, and I just want to emphasize that. His boss, the president of Avista, deals with a number of states, and he is the chair of the commission, Washington State's Economic Development Commission. He's the competition, and he's jealous about what we have. I don't think now's the time to change it. So with that, I would close. I'd love to take any questions.
You're my friend.
Yeah.
I truly admire the honesty and the integrity you bring to everything you do.
Thank you.
And I think that's very admirable. I think it's very brave for you to stand up and to just speak your heart in what you believe, but I think that's also who you are.
They get you one term in office.
Let me ask you this question. If you're sitting in this chair and you brought a problem forward and you said this isn't working, and over the course of 4 months you hadn't heard an alternative solution, would you scratch your head and say,
absolutely,
maybe I can find the solution myself?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And again, I'm praising you. I'm saying you're the guy that's challenging. You're the guy that's making this conversation happen. We're just not blindly walking into the next 2 years. We're examining things as a result of your role, and I think that's good.
I truly appreciate that. You and I have had good conversations, mm-hmm. and I think this is a department that does very, very well. I think they have great tools. Sometimes it's good to get the WD-40 out and.
Mm-hmm.
Up the tool.
So, you bet.
Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but who won the tennis game?
I think Christy did.
Mm-hmm. Good dad.
Yeah.
you are looking at the greatest dad in the world right there. So, Mr. Cole, it's good having you here. Please send the best to your wife and the girls.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Anyone else? I'm sure there's not going to be any objection. We're going to adjourn until tomorrow. So, thank you.
I need to sign that sheet.
Ooh, let me find it.